Yeah. sagen, diese Puppies sind genau. Was ist was 18 zu sehen? Oh nein, nein.
No, no, it's fine. She can sit there.
Oh, no, that's yeah. Okay. So...
She can take this one.
Okay.
Yeah, so 30 and 31 is so, but then so not the... The 26 to this 9:30 option, obviously, is missing. And then, where's our Vodacom? Oh, Vodacom's here. Yeah. Where's Vodacom again? Yeah, the 6th of October.
Polls.
Yes, polls is 10 to 13, and then they want to set it down
19,
the next Friday. Okay, at least it's not the day after, but still.
Oh.
19:20, the next is...
It means Monday to Thursday we're in consultation. There's no word on the console, hey?
No, I haven't seen anything.
But it's almost impossible.
You always get it right. Anyway, it tells me to do this. No, I'm not going to say, listen to you. We are planning to learn our own event, defend the company, it's too expensive. Have a research.
PM will never say that. Remember stock loss? Yes. Someone had offered to run that matter.
Yeah.
Because it was one of the simple ones.
Yeah.
And ran up with the little million.
Yeah, it is a bit of an effort. I'm not responsible for this.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's not uncomfortable. His budget doesn't
mean yeah, but then you don't want to lose, right?
But that's the problem that it takes a bit of people to support it. They can revoke your license. I mean,
You don't want to lose. The thing is, this council, they're ripened in that environment. We don't argue it. You can easily do it, but we don't do it every day.
I'm John from Michael.
So it's not going to come across the way council makes it come across in a
country.
But I agree, maybe a junior. Junior, senior, whatever. Middleweight junior.
Senior, junior.
You can't be not
supposed
to be. Some juniors who can really run a matter and not get it all done.
He's got a shifting from Sethi to Yetsuba.
And Yetsuba...
He's got to focus on Yetsuba for drafting. Now all he needs is a bit of
work. Sethi for both. I struggle to follow where she's going. Maybe Chris McConaughey.
Chris McConaughey. What are the chances?
He's Otherwise...
No, he's very bright and he likes more than
I know.
Communista, when are we going to do anything?
He said quarter to
1:40, 3 minutes ago.
Do you think I'm
going to hi, how are you?
You know?
Let's take our seats, please. Let's take our seats and give a ear to Sabrik. We are asked to switch. Now the honorable members are not here.
The one we launched just now, the 3 year census in June.
Oh, yes, you said just not for this one because it was previously something that was hard to consider. That's the last decision.
But the thing is, none of us know him.
Good afternoon, honourable members and chairperson. Thank you so much for the opportunity. I'm from SABRIC. Just swapped around. Thank you so much. My name is Susan Portgieter. I'm with SABRIC. SABRIC is the acronym for the South African Banking Risk Information Centre. And we are a non-profit company that was formed by the banks to support them in their fight against crime. And in that regard, what we do is we facilitate various initiatives. We also encourage collaboration between the banks and support them in that regard, and also keep statistics on crime incidents for the purposes of understanding the threats that we're having to deal with. We currently have 19 banks as members, 3 CIT companies and 1 ATM manufacturer, and that is because of the link between the different crime types. I'm very happy if any further clarification with regard to our role is required. I'm very happy to expand on that should there be any questions in that regard. We also partner with government organizations to support them in reaching their national objectives and so forth where possible, and try and make a contribution as a sector to make South Africa a safer place to be. Chairperson, when it comes to cyber security, cyber crime and cyber security, I'd say that from a banking industry perspective, cyber security is probably the more important aspect, whilst we do in fact acknowledge and are very grateful for the progress that's been made with this particular bill, especially if you look at the version that was first published for comment in 2015 versus what's on the table today. We most certainly believe that cyber crimes is generally, and I say generally, a consequence of lack of cybersecurity, and that's why cybersecurity is so important to us. So from a cybersecurity perspective, the South African banking industry is having to deal with exactly the same types of threats as the rest of the globe. We are no different. The threat is a global threat, and already today mention has been made of ransomware and the fact that everybody had to grapple with WannaCry in May. That was followed by Petya, not Petya. And as recently as last week, and this is just a little bit tongue on the cheek, I saw that the criminals have now reduced the ransom for Queen Princess from what was last year 3 bitcoins amounting to about $13,000 to something as low as $350,000 as at last week. Now, whilst we all know that the threat of cyber crime is something that also affects the citizens of South Africa, what we need to appreciate is that not all the citizens of South Africa actually know how to deal with it. And regrettably, these criminals are even teaching them how to pay the ransom in bitcoins. And because the charge involved is so low, one of the concerns that we have is that people might actually pay because it's easier. They might find it easier to pay than to actually deal with the threat. So from our perspective, investing in cybersecurity is a high priority. A lot of work is being done in that respect, and we are doing our utmost to put measures in place to monitor the threats of cybersecurity and to be able to come up with a South African perspective of what we actually being confronted with. Cybersecurity information and information about cyber globally is very available, you know, if you do any searches on the internet and so forth. But for me, the missing part is local information. There's really a problem with local information, and we hope that through our efforts at SABRIC, we will be able to partner with our members and be able to give those with a vested interest a South African perspective of what the threat against South Africa is. Interesting to note is that many of the attacks are still targeted at individuals, and if you look at the international research that is on the screen right now, this is statistics that were gathered and analysis done in July of this year. You will see that malware is a problem, and most certainly cybercrime is very high on the agenda of criminals. Not to make the threat of hacktivism or any of the others less important, but from where we sit, we are very focused on mitigating the cybercrime risk per se. So if we move on to cybercrime in the banking industry, it really affects our sector. It affects our sector all round. Not only do we have to look after the infrastructure of the banking industry, If you look at cards, something that all of you and all of us use every day, we've had to grapple with the threat of card skimming, and there the ECT Act has been widely used by the banks in the past or by the prosecutors to prosecute in bank-related cases in the past. But if you look at just our operating systems for the ATM infrastructure in the country, there's an excess of 30,000 ATMs out in the field, and all of those are functioning on computerized operating systems. An interesting point also to note is that even when it comes to violent crimes, bank-related violent crimes, we are being affected by cyber crimes. It's no secret that criminals use cell phone blockers in order to disable the security measures put in place by banks so that the alarm signals can't go off. And then, also no surprise, banking has been moving towards digital platforms quite aggressively over the last couple of years, and we must expect that in years to come, the brick-and-mortar banking environment that we're all familiar with now will be less frequent. So cybersecurity and cybercrime is something that is very close to us, and we really, really are very pleased that the bill has been progressed to the state that it is, and we are very supportive of the efforts that are being made to criminalize these activities that impact negatively on our customers and our sector. We are often asked, what is the extent of bank-related cybercrime? And this is a very, very difficult question to answer. First and foremost, what constitutes a cybercrime? I want to use the example of a ATM where the face of the ATM has been harmed and there's a hole drilled into the face of the ATM. One would not be wrong to think at face value that is malicious damage to property. But those with a little bit more knowledge will know that that is the prepping for a cyber attack, because what criminals are doing, and this is rife in other jurisdictions, touch wood, we haven't had an incident in South Africa yet, they drill a hole in the face of the ATM in order to get their hand in order to interfere with the internal operating system. So how would you classify that? Probably a police official who's confronted with such an incident will log it as a violent crime, malicious damage, but it's actually prepping for a cyber crime. So the point I'm making here, Chair, is that it's complex to quantify. Also, when we talk about how complex it is, if you look at some of the proposed offences in the bill itself, I'm going to use a simple one, the compromise of passwords. How do you put a monetary value to that? It most certainly must be a cybercrime, but to quantify it is very, very difficult because it doesn't have a commercial value that is self-explanatory. So what we've done at SABRIC is we have put together some figures that we're sharing with this committee today to give you a feel of the extent, and I'm very comfortable to say that an estimated figure for the period July to June this year, if I look at two areas of crime, the one being card not present and counterfeit card fraud, and the other being digital banking fraud, very comfortable to say that approximately 150,000 individual incidents have been reported with a rand value estimated at 350 million just for the first 6 months of the year. Now, if you go back to what I've just said with regard to quantification, and we look at the root causes that led to these frauds, those in themselves were also cyber crimes, and there's no monetary value attached to that. Chair, if any further information with regard to the extent is required, very happy to address the committee on specific issues in that regard. We are very, very pleased, as I said, with the progress made, and we believe that this bill is necessary for the country. We also believe that it's a huge step in the right direction. Not only does it bring consolidate different pieces of legislation that was previously fragmented, it also aligns very well with international best practices and puts us in a very good position in order to engage globally on matters of cybercrime and cybersecurity. We're very pleased also to see that the bill makes a provision for the police to rely on expertise from the private sector in certain cases when it comes to the investigation of crime, and we hope that that is going to be an opportunity that's going to be used. Of course, the penalties are far more appropriate than the ones that were previously contained in the ECT Act, and that is also a welcome by us. Chairperson, we have a couple of suggestions to make, and we really believe that the first suggestion that I'd like to make is one, making a case for greater collaboration and engagement with the private sector. We really believe that the private sector has a huge vested interest in cybersecurity and will be able to make valuable contribution at policy level as well. And we would like to suggest that consideration be given to a structure where there can be engagement between public and private sector at policy level on cybersecurity related matters. We have lots of experience in our sector, and I'm sure in other sectors as well. And at the end of the day, because we are all very, very concerned about South Africa and the South African public not being abused, we most certainly would like to contribute where we can at policy level as well. Then, Chair, moving on to the role of private sector certs, you may be aware of the fact that that SABRIC hosts the banking industry sector cert, and that we were, to the best of my knowledge, the first sector to actually go down that road voluntarily. Believe that the fact that we did it voluntarily and that it's actually working is largely because of the fact that the space is not over-regulated, and we'd like to caution against over-regulating certs, because the magic actually lies in the collaboration. It's not a tick box exercise from a banking industry perspective. It's about expertise being shared and appropriate information being shared timelessly so that everybody has a fair chance to protect themselves. We are looking forward to working with the Cybersecurity Hub and hope that the information is not going to flow in one direction only, and trust that the framework provided by the bill will enable information to flow from government to private sector as well, because at the end of the day, both public and private have the same vested interest. Chair, when it comes to international collaboration, it's something that we are very, very, very keen on, and something that we believe cannot be overemphasized. South Africa, both public and private sector, has to be part of the international community. The cyber criminals most certainly aren't precious about who they target. It is a global threat. So our participation in the right fora and in the right initiative is going to be critical. Then, Chair, almost through with my points, just one quick point to be made, and that is the importance of skills and resources. We submit that currently in the private sector, as well as from our experience engaging with the public sector, and specifically I'm now wanting to refer to law enforcement because we work closely with them, we have a long road to go. There definitely is a dire shortage of skills in the country, and there's a large dependency about being, on skills for this bill and the legal framework to have an impact in the greater scheme of things. So we'd like to highlight the need for skills and encourage the committee to please apply its mind to how we can jointly partner in order to fill this the skills gap. And then, Chair, just in closing, we can have the best legal framework in the world without bringing and equipping the citizens of South Africa with sufficient information and bringing them along this journey. I can tell you from our experience already, the criminals will target them. We're finding that our customers are the preferred target of the criminals because there is an assumption that they may not have sufficient information, and there's also the assumption that they are not investing sufficiently in cybersecurity. So, Chair, that is my very brief input, and very happy to expand on any point, either verbally or in writing, if you would like for SABRIC to do so.
Honourable members, that's a very clear and pointed presentation. Honourable Mutapo.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you, SABRIC, for the presentation. Chairperson, I'm that much interested in this bill because I was, especially when it relates to banking, such as I was a victim to this bank loan. Yes, I was a victim. That's why I'm so interested. I had to research it. You know, this bank scheming thing, Chairperson, there is this machine which they normally use. You know it, ne? You go to the bank, to an ATM outside. Then, when you arrive there, you again normally supposed to say insert card. So you'll find it as something like WAP. What does it mean? Wireless? What? WAP and other things. And then as soon as you arrive there, you insert your card. Then the card details get copied into this machine. It's a small one. The information which appears on the bank card get copied on that small machine, and then you withdraw, you take your card, then they come and remove that small machine with all your information while still in possession of that card, bank card of yours. They are able to withdraw money because the information has been stored in the criminal's machine. And then also I'm told that when we enter our PIN outside at the ATM, it takes a few minutes for that information to lapse. Then I'm told the criminals are able to come with a smartphone and a thermal imaging equipment to trace that information, and then they are able to have access to our details. So, as SABRIC, what measures are you taking? Because I personally, having been a victim, it's for the first time, thanks for my organization for bringing me here, it's for the first time hearing about you. And you, in your presentation, you said you are having 19 banks as your members. So how will the public who are also victims, how will they get access to yourself? In which areas besides the banks are you operating, isn't it? Especially the rural public, because we are the ones, we people from rural areas, we are so respectful. If a person says, then we think it's respecting us. Until now, they have got their own thing in place. It happens around in one of the provinces. And then again, there is this flare one thermal image camera. So maybe you may also update us on that, on how these things impact on assist in commission of this cyber crime, especially in the financial institution. You said you have 19 banks. What about other institutions or service providers which provide financial services in terms of financial services board regulations? Are they not part of SAPRIC? And the public would also like to know how safe is cell phone banking and internet banking? Because nowadays, most of the people are doing that. Okay. Thank you, Chair, for now.
Government, do you work with SASA as well?
Oh, I forgot something, Chair. But also, the public-private partnership, I've seen NPA and others. Chairperson reminded me when he made mention of SASA. So, because also in SASA, in especially our people who are the elderly who are receiving pension payout fall victim to that. So, also assist in that, your comment in that. And then public-private partnerships. Also expand on that, because I've seen the NPA and other departments, although the slides here, the one we are having, the document you gave us is not legible enough. But generally, thank you so much for the presentation.
Well, the right to know, were very passionate in insisting, or rather appealing, to an arrangement where a bill like this would be bottom-up rather than top-down. Now, my question is, given that you represent the different banks, you represent various banks. What is your role to have right to know, to have an arrangement or a scenario where a bill as critical as this one is rather driven bottom up, and how bottom up? By means of ensuring that there is a massive awareness campaign around a bill like this, and the implications of people being somehow reckless or not knowing about the consequences should their personal information fall in wrong hands. So what is it that you can contribute other than just to make a formal presentation like this, practically on the ground, with communities, with community-based organizations to teach or educate our people? And I guess that because we've got capital as a banking industry, you can help to reach out to so many other people. What is it that you can do?
Chairperson, just to thank you for the presentation. And to say that it's an opportunity for the banking sector to really have a good protection mechanism with this. And I think it's important that you actually manage to articulate clearly how to deal with hacking, how to deal with cloning the cards, how to deal with the bombing ATMs also with the intention of stealing the monies, because I imagine those are the kinds of challenges that you're actually experiencing. And you have actually indicated that the provision on the requirement to assist the law enforcement officers has got a problem. I want to know how you want to articulate that to be actually put into the bill in such a way that it then assists you with this concern. You've also indicated that you need clear definition of electronic communication identity. If you can just expatiate also on that one.
Thank you, Honourable Chairperson.
With regard to the skimming incident and the fact that the Honourable Member was a victim, I'm sorry to hear about that. Unfortunately, it is skimming is still a huge challenge on a daily basis, and it is the way you explained it, that criminals use digital devices to steal information, is absolutely accurate. With regard to the compromise of the PIN number, in our experience, however, is it's less technical. People actually look over people's shoulders, but I am aware of the literature available about the thermal thermal way where they use infrarays and so forth in order to determine what numbers were pushed based on heat and so forth. We have never recovered any of those devices in the South African context, so touch wood, fortunately, that doesn't seem to have reached our shores as yet. With regard to the measures that SABRIC is taking, it is our mandate to support the banks with consumer education, and we have a whole array of activities and have been doing so for many, many years. For example, as recently as this morning, we had a TV insert on Espresso where our CEO was educating the public on phishing and how phishing works. We go as far as community radio, where we try and cover as many languages as possible, because we also believe that if you communicate in somebody's home language, there's a better learning experience than just communicating in English. So please do also visit our website. There's a lot of awareness material on the website, and we also use social media extensively to create consumer awareness. So that is probably our biggest contribution. We don't have a call center that the public can call into, but we do find that once we've done a campaign, that people phone the reception or use our website, info@SABRIC, and we respond to those calls should we receive them. We also direct consumers who have issues to engage their own banks, because all of the banks, all of our members themselves, have very robust awareness programs in place as well. With regard to the 19 banks, the prerequisite for and where SABRIC's mandate comes from is that if a bank is a member of BASA, then they are entitled to become a voluntary member of SABRIC. I'm expecting that with the changes and the Twin Peaks model that's now being going to be implemented, that our board may or may not take that into consideration to expand our membership criteria going forward. But currently, the voluntary organization has been set up and funded as a sub-initiative initiating originally from BASA, so that's our parent company, just to put a little bit of context to how all of that works. With regard to the safety of mobile and internet banking, the product design and architecture and security measures used by banks are continuously being reviewed. We're finding that in spite of each and every effort, criminals follow the route of least resistance. And very interesting, the modus operandi that are most prevalent in mobile banking at the moment is as basic as social engineering. So it doesn't have anything to do with digital platforms and so forth. Criminals are phoning victims and tricking them into disclosing personal information and then using it against them. So we're finding that the security has to be reviewed continuously, and banks do that. And in our view, the safety and the safety mechanisms deployed remain a very, very high priority and are effective. With regard to our relationship with SASSA, we don't have a permanent working relationship or an MOU with SASSA at the moment, but we have worked with SASSA on investigations where we were able to support them from our knowledge base, and where the perpetrators, for example, that bomb bank-branded ATMs are not excluding the SASSA ATMs. So where there's common opportunity to share information and to collaborate in the greater good, we are certainly open to that, and we have done that in the past. With regard to our public-private partnerships, The organizations or the government departments that we engage primarily with are the ones who have a vested interest in combating specific crimes that are of mutual interest. So when it comes to law enforcement, we really very supportive of the law enforcement's efforts to combat crime, and in that regard, where we are able to contribute to capacity building, we must certainly do our best. Our contribution is to share with law enforcement what bank systems entail, so that they know how to investigate, not to teach them or to try and interfere with due process, but to just give the banking perspective so that can assist them. With regard to balancing and Honourable Member, your question around right to know, my summary of the point, and I hope that I've understood you correctly, is where does the balance come in between human rights and consumer rights and making sure that there's ample response and control over the crime situation? We most certainly believe that that there has to be a balance. The citizens whose rights must be protected, and by no means are we saying that there should be a sway to the other side of the spectrum, but those same citizens expect our industry, for example, to protect them as well. And there has to be a balance, because without information, it's very, very difficult to combat crime, effectively. We believe that our contribution when it comes to consumer education is a valuable one, and we will continue to go the extra mile to make sure that the correct information and shared timelessly with our bank, our customers who are our consumers who are the general public. Most certainly, there is a lot to be done when it comes to cyber security. We speak about cyber crime a lot. But I believe that we must speak just as much and equip our consumers with information from a security perspective as well. And you will see in some of our campaigns that is actually the objective. Chairperson, if there's any point that I might have left out, the members are welcome to remind me, and I'll do my best to respond.
Thank you, Chair. On consumer awareness, she made mention that they go to various radio stations and they call. You also cover deep rural communities, like in our case, it will be Travel FM, Eastern Cape, Travelonene, and then Nganalonene, that side of Limpopo, and... Oh, my apologies. Okay, thank you, Chair. I was saying that in terms of consumer awareness, you said you normally go to radio station. And then my question is that you said in various languages. So I was referring to, like, in Eastern Cape, Nganalonene, and other radio stations. And KwaZulu-Natal, it will be Cozy FM. The languages which are spoken by the majority in that particular province, like here in the Western Cape, it will be Xhosa and maybe part of Afrikaans, but majority might be Xhosa. So in Limpopo, Travel FM, Palapala, and that other one, Munganalonene. So what I'm trying to say, do you also go deep to an extent of making use of community radio stations? Because most of the victims will be those ones which, deep down in rural area, hence the chairperson making mention of SASA. Those are the greatest victims. That's unfortunately here next door. I was here next door earlier on, 226, where DTI was dealing with this Mashonisa thing. That so they are also preparing themselves to go to rural areas to educate people, especially on this pension payout thing. Thank you.
Thank you for the question, Honourable Member. Yes, I've been personally involved in campaigns where we've contracted, because it's you have to pay for the airtime, where we've contracted through agencies packages that takes us across community radio stations in all provinces. And what we do then is we use people for interviews that are have the command of the local language, and we also do pre-recordings. So those have been quite successful. They're not always very effective when it comes to scheduled engagement, because we find that that very often the resources available to the community radio stations are far less than one would expect. But most certainly we've tried it, and we're satisfied that our attempts were worth our while. We don't have it, Honourable Member, as a consistent activity, but we have specific campaigns, and most certainly the ATM and the ATM environment is always on the agenda, because we believe that a lot of the crime these days is focused in the vicinity of the ATM. Yes, my response, Honourable Member, was in relation to community radio stations and the campaigns that we do through acquiring packages through agencies that take us and buy us time on a whole portfolio of community radio stations at a time across the country.
The Khoza radio station is umhlobo wenene. Then Tsonga one in Limpopo is umngana lo nene. Yes. SABC will fight with me.
Intend to mislead, then that's why you are correcting. And thank you very much for the pointed question. And may we excuse you. Mike Kelson, and thank you for accommodating colleagues who are in trouble with time.
Thank you very much for giving me an opportunity to talk to you today. I greatly appreciate it. So my name is John Giles, and I'm the managing attorney at a law firm called Michelson's Attorneys. And I have focused on the area where law and technology meet for about 20 years. So anywhere where those two intersect is something that I'm interested in and something that I've focused on. I've also been involved in King Code and a few other legislative processes, and done quite a lot on legal drafting and plain language. So Michelson's is a law firm, but it's a tough act to follow, particularly the presentation before lunch, because I'm obviously an attorney and I'm a lawyer. So I'm hoping to make this practical and useful for you guys today. So Michelson's, we are a corporate law firm, but we practice law differently. We believe the law should be accessible. Okay. All right. Sorry, Honourable Andrew. So we believe the law should be accessible, empowering, and helpful. And really, that's why I'm here today. I'm not here representing clients. I'm not here representing a bank. I'm representing myself, and I'm here voluntarily to hopefully make a difference, and that's why I'm here. So I'd like to think I'm here representing the people in a way, and I'd like to tell you a story that is a classic story that we get involved in. A couple bought a house and they signed the sale agreement. It was their dream house, which they then bought and signed the agreement. Shortly after they had done that, the sale agreement said they had to pay a 10% deposit. They received an email from the transferring attorney asking them to pay the 10% deposit, which they duly did. And about 5 days later, the transferring attorney phoned them again and said, you have to pay the 10% deposit. And they said, no, we've already paid the 10% deposit. And what had happened is a cyber criminal had basically pretended to be the law firm, sent them an email from that law firm's mail address, and given it was exactly a spoof email. It was perfect, except for the bank details. The bank details were that of the cyber criminal. So what then happened is the couple, their money had been stolen. That 10% had been stolen by a criminal. And they then lost the house because they couldn't pay them another 10% for the property. So in that sort of scenario, what we're trying to do is we're trying to catch the criminal. And that's where the cybercrimes bill comes in, particularly the cybercrimes component. And in that regard, we welcome the bill and fully support it. We want to be catching cyber criminals because we're protecting people from harm, which is something that I'm very passionate about. We also, in that scenario, we want to ensure that various people protect the personal information of that couple to stop the criminal getting the information and then stealing their money. So that's where the Protection of Personal Information Act comes into play, and that obliges people to protect that couple's personal information. So we're looking good, but there's some dangers involved in that scenario, and that's really what I'm wanting to highlight in this presentation today. And I'm afraid it's going to get quite technical, but we've made a submission which deals with a few things, but I really wanted to talk today and highlight one point which I think is best illustrated by presenting it and showing you some images and particularly some circles. So I'm going to go through that, and it's about data crimes and how we actually define them. And then at the end, I'm going to show you actual examples of the sections, and we've got suggested amendments that we think should be made. So let's have a look at at the scope. So if we look at crimes, and I'm going to go into the scope of the crimes, and I think this ties in nicely with what we've been discussing in the rest of, or we'll be discussing for the rest of the day. So let's picture that green circle. That is conduct or behavior. And we're going to be slicing and dicing that in different ways. So we start off with a default position of a big green circle, which is freedom, or people have rights. Now, we've discussed this a lot, rights and responsibilities, and I agree with you. It's very important to balance the two. But if we start with freedom and we look at three examples, number one is you access data with authorization. For example, each of us here picking up a cell phone and looking at our email, we're accessing information with authorization. Second example is you process personal information unlawfully. So this is now, despite you really trying, you as a responsible party in terms of POPIA or the Protection of Personal Information Act do not process personal information lawfully. The third one is you access a bank account without authority. So those are three examples of conduct or behavior that I want to look at in more detail. So we can't obviously let people do what they want. There have to be responsibilities. There's got to be the balancing. So I want to show you how, in my view, we introduce control. What we do, and this is to create a good balance, we say some conduct is unlawful, and that is the orange circle. So firstly, let's look at lawful conduct is anything that's permitted or allowed by law. Unlawful conduct then is conduct that's prohibited by law, things that you can't do. But the key point is that is not criminal. We make some unlawful acts criminal, not all unlawful acts criminal. And the great example here is the Protection of Personal Information Act. There are some things that are crimes, but very few. The rest is just unlawful to process personal information. There's a very big difference between unlawful and criminal. So we also, in terms of the onus, we presume somebody to be innocent until they're proven guilty, until they're proven to be in the red circle. So again, the examples, you've got one, two, and three. One would be us accessing data with authorization. We should be allowed to do that. Number two is you unlawfully process personal information in terms of POPIA. That's unlawful. And then the third one, you access a bank without authority. That is criminal. That is a crime. And then when you get to criminal behavior, there's a green circle in it because you can have certain defenses. You can say, yes, I accessed the bank, but I had authorization, or it was lawful. And that's an important distinction to make. So this, in many ways, is what we're aiming for. And for me, this creates a good balance, and everybody's happy. We catch the criminals, but we also then don't infringe on others' rights or fall into some of the dangers. And I want to move across to what those dangers are. So the dangers are, if we make too many crimes, and bearing in mind this bill is going to introduce about 57 crimes, we end up with a scenario where there's no longer any unlawful behavior. It's criminal or lawful, and there's very little lawful. We want to have a good balance. So that's what we really need to be careful of. And we also want to be careful of introducing a reverse onus, where somebody is presumed guilty until they can show that they're innocent. So in a scenario where we get it wrong, we're going to end up with all three of those things being crimes. Even if you pick up your phone and you access data, you're a criminal if we get it wrong. And that's what we have to be careful of. We don't want to make all of us criminals, including public servants. And here, it's a very important thing, because public bodies, they can only act if authorized by law to act. So if they are not acting in accordance with that law, then potentially it's unlawful conduct. If the Cybercrimes Bill makes that a crime, all unlawful conduct becomes illegal or criminal, which is what we want to avoid. And also that reverse onus, we must use it very sparingly, and I think the presentation before lunch relating to revenge porn was a very good example of maybe where the reverse onus is justified. All right, so let's look at how we limit it. So there are a couple of ways. The first is, we say you must have intended to do that act. And that reduces the red circle down, which is definitely a step in the right direction. So generally speaking, intention is a good thing to include. The two words that you'll notice appear often within the sections is unlawfully and intentionally. And for us, these two words are very problematic because it's difficult to understand how they relate to each other. So if it's you must have intentionally acted unlawfully, that means the person will have to have known every single law in South Africa in order to know whether they're intentionally acting unlawfully or not, which none of us know all the laws in South Africa. I don't think there's anyone who does. So that for us is a problem. But so moving on to the word of unlawfully and including that into the picture, because unlawfully is included in every section, what we've done is we've made virtually all unlawful conduct criminal conduct, which in my view cannot be the case. So what we're wanting, this is the solution in my view. We want to leave it that you have lawful, unlawful, criminal conduct with a defense that's possible. And another point to point out here is that all criminal conduct is unlawful. That's why the red circle's in the orange circle. But not all unlawful conduct is criminal. It's exactly, POPIA is the perfect example. Parliament purposefully did not criminalize the unlawful processing of personal information. And that's in line with international trends. And what we mustn't do here is have the Cybercrimes Bill criminalize POPIA. And that's what one of the risks is that we face. So for us, the three solutions is to be more precise in criminalizing conduct, make lawfulness a defense, not part of the description of the crime, and remove the reverse onus in many instances where it's not appropriate. So very succinctly, those are the three solutions that we have. And if we get back to our examples 1, 2, and 3, we'd be left with, I can access my phone and I'm not a criminal. Number 2 would be, I can unlawfully process personal information. There are consequences in that people can sue me, but it's not criminal behavior. And the last one is, we're catching cyber criminals in the red circle at the bottom. So everybody's happy. So let's now go to some examples. And I want to show you, particularly with when it comes to data, there are particularly 3 crimes that are in the Cyber Crimes Bill that relate particularly to data. There was lots of mention earlier about the Budapest Convention and the AU Convention. And just to show you quickly there, there's the ECT Act. You'll notice there's no mention of unlawfulness in there. It's only intentionally. If we look here at the AU Convention, again, it talks about unauthorized access, but there's no mention there of unlawfulness. And there's the Budapest Convention, again, also not mentioning unlawfulness. So let's look at the first of the data crimes and look at accessing data. And there's the section there, and sorry, that's not particularly clear. But our recommendation would be to delete the word unlawfully and in each of these sections. Because if we start off with, if we forget the carve-outs, as it were, the way it reads is, any person who accesses data is guilty of an offense. If we leave it at that, that's absolutely all of us have committed an offense. So intentionally certainly helps, but unlawfully is put in the wrong place, because as part of the definition of the crime, it needs to be part of a defense. And that for us is a key point. So with section 2.1, we also want to insert these words, by overcoming any reasonable protection measure which is intended to prevent access. Very important, that's defining it more precisely and removing that unlawfully. And then introducing this and without authorization, which is really just bringing this up from the bottom section over here, where it's buried over there. It really needs to be right at the beginning of the description. You'll also notice there authorization includes lawfully entitled to access. So there it's correctly dealt with where it's a defense. It's not part of the definition of a crime. All right, so then the next one is acquiring, and it's a very similar thought process here, taking out that unlawfully, adding in without authorization. You'll see there are the words dealing with overcoming any reasonable protection measure. And this 3.2, without those changes, is very problematic in that it really makes virtually everybody in South Africa a criminal. And I'm not just talking about banks and hospitals and clinics. I'm talking about all of us, absolutely all of us. So then 3.3 is a classic reverse onus, and we believe that that reverse onus should be removed. We don't think it's justifiable in those circumstances. Yeah, so that's the one dealing with acquiring. And then interfering, it's similar thoughts and similar suggestions. All right, so if we go back and really in conclusion, I would like to summarize our recommendations. For us, we want to be aiming for those circles in that way. We want to be much more precise in criminalizing conduct, in saying what is criminal behavior and what's not. We want to make lawfulness a defense, not part of the description of the crime. We want to remove the reverse onus in many instances. And then the last point, we are very much in favor of the cybercrime aspects of this bill, but we do believe that cybercrime and cybersecurity are separate issues, and that cybersecurity should be dealt with separately and not part of this bill. And thank you very much. That's really what I wanted to convey today.
Thank you very much for your public spirit. You know, some lawyers do not only want to make money, they don't want to make time to make a
point he makes about separating the two concepts, the cyberspace from the cyber security. The intention of the bill is to combat cybercrimes. Cybercrimes. So if that instrument was to be applied effectively, why should the two be separated? But then secondly, do you seem, it's like you sound as if you propose that the wedding intentionally should be done away with. I speak under correction. Is it that way? It's not intentional, is it?
Yeah, our suggestion is to remove unlawfully, but leave intentionally in.
Or leave intentionally. The previous, someone who came before you proposed that the word intentional should be removed because it would be difficult in law to prove the presence of intention in the commissioning of crime. I don't know, sitting from where you are seated, whether do you agree with such a proposition that in law it would be difficult to prove whether someone has intention to commit crime or not. And if you hold a different view, perhaps it would be good if you share that.
I want to take all the comments before you. Honorable Horn. Yes, Chairperson, thank you. I just want to have comment on the principle that in our criminal law, unlawfulness is one of the requirements for somebody to be criminally liable. One of the elements, one of the hurdles the state must overcome to ultimately establish guilt. And how we will then address that if we take away the requirement that these actions must not be unlawful.
Yeah, thanks, Chair. And thanks for the presentation. I think it shows that we have put some work to assemble the presentation. A lot of thoughts went into the presentation. And to me, it now gets to be a bit technical or academic. Because I want you to comment strictly on the last point that we've raised there. You know, the importance of us having to separate the two.
Still young, don't say the last point you put there. Mention the point.
Oh yeah, I was mentioning the point. Separating the cyber crime and the cyber security. Because from where I'm sitting, the two are almost intertwined. If you separate them, you may have unintended consequences of what you want to achieve. So just clear my mind on why do you want us to separate the two. And if you say unlawfulness, something that is unlawful may not be criminal. Then if we were to take it back, then what will be the harm? What is the harm then? Because not everything, according to you, not everything that is unlawful may be criminal. So what is the harm of just having that that unlawfulness there? But the important point is when we're doing a criminal law many, many years ago when we're students, they will list the elements that you must, you know, like Honorable Juan is saying, this you must have, this you must have, this you must have. Then it completes the picture either of a prima facie case to proceed and so on. But now if we remove the unlawfulness, we may be just involved in an academic exercise, because the main intention of this bill is to combat this thing. We're told it's one of the serious crime in the space, and as we deal with it, we need to be as hard as possible. So I want you to just comment on those three aspects that I've raised. Also in line with the general law that is there, that crime needs 1, 2, 3. Not unless, from where I'm sitting, it's like you want to come inside, you want to regulate what is happening in that space, as opposed to what we intend to do. What we intend to do is to criminalize and arrest so that people can deter. We're told that the report says cybercrime accounts to billions and billions of rands in this country alone, let alone the continent. So I think if you can assist me on those three aspects, then we'll take it from there. But I should say this, a lot of work was put in preparing the presentation.
But especially in terms of unlawfulness, I was a bit concerned if it's removed. Thank you, Chair.
Sure, yes. Thank you, Chair. Yes, thank you very much for the questions. I mean, this is a very difficult issue. We 12 attorneys in the office, and we've debated for probably 6 hours on this issue, trying to work out what should be done. And I'll try and explain it as succinctly as possible. The fact that we remove unlawfully doesn't mean we're removing unlawfully from that crime. So that's why the red circle's in the orange circle. You don't need to say unlawfully accesses data in order for it to be a crime. The fact that you've said you've accessed without authorization, that makes it unlawful. The unlawfulness becomes part of the defense. So if we get back to your point, and I think this example illustrates it, if somebody, and it actually relates to a lot of the questions that you asked, the Cybercrimes Bill, we're trying to catch criminals harming people, citizens. That's really what we're aiming for. The Cybercrimes Bill does not require anybody to secure information, and that's why the name Cybercrime and Cybersecurity Bill is misleading. It's actually the Protection of Personal Information Act that requires people to secure information. That's the security law. POPIA is the security law. So in POPIA scenario, we say that people must secure information. They must take reasonable and appropriate measures to secure it. And if you don't, it's unlawful. The harm that gets suffered is our couple who've lost that 10% deposit. It's the poor who get become a victim of an SMS scam. That's the harm that they're suffering, and it's due to unlawful conduct, which is not criminal. It's just unlawful. So in POPIA, if you unlawfully process, you fail to protect personal information, you're not committing a crime. You don't go to jail. But there are consequences in that you can be fined with an administrative fine, or the data subject can sue you for damages and claim that damages back. So for me, by taking unlawfully out, we're not making the crimes less. We're just keeping them where they should be, and we're not extending the crimes to also cover unlawful conduct. I'm afraid that's about as best as I can explain it. Very much the defense would include the unlawfulness, but it shouldn't be part of the definition of the crime. So I hope I'm making sense in terms of that. And definitely I wasn't suggesting we remove intentionally. And I think that's also a criticism of the bill, is that we use unlawfully and intentionally for every crime. And sometimes it fits, sometimes it doesn't fit. So it might not fit in the revenge porn scenario. But it might fit in others, and I think it fits in many of these. But it's the concept of unlawfulness that again shouldn't be used blanketly throughout the crimes. It needs to be carved out and used specifically. And for me, really, the right term rather than unlawfully is without authorization in the context of the data crimes. Those sections.
If we marry what you are saying with what the young doctor said, she says there are two people, they are in love, they exchange information, the other party gets that information, not unlawfully, but suddenly when the relationship gets sour, the other party uses that information to harm. So it begins to make more sense. So it doesn't have to have been acquired. The information doesn't have to have been acquired unlawfully. So, but proceed and enlighten us further. And you may come back and engage, because this is a revolutionary contribution, I think.
I agree with you that I think this is a very technical discussion, and I don't claim to have the answers. I'm merely highlighting what I think is an issue. And I'd be very happy to engage afterwards at another time to go through the technical aspects of it. But for me, what was really confirmatory to what I was thinking is that if you look at the conventions like the African Union Convention, and you look at the ECT Act, and you look at other crimes, that word unlawfully is not there. And there must be a reason for that. And for me, it's because you don't want to equate criminal and unlawful behavior, there needs to be a difference. So then the other question was around separating security from the cybercrime aspects of this bill. For me, there's also a big difference between protecting people from cybercriminals and protecting the state. And I'm not for a minute saying that we mustn't protect South Africa from criminals. We need to. We need to protect our borders. We've seen many examples around the world. But for me, the two issues don't marry well, and they should be dealt with separately in different acts, which is the point that I'm making at the end there. So I think I've covered the questions, but I'm very happy to take further questions.
Follow-up. So you said this the naming of this bill is misleading. You say the Justice Department is misleading us by saying the bill is crime and cyber security bill. So I'm not expecting you to answer now, but if you are able to, you may answer. So what are you proposing? Because you can't just say they are misleading, and then you are sort of
they are misleading, that it is misleading.
It is misleading. Okay, thank you for the correction. And then you made mention of Protection of Personal Information Act. So also in vis-a-vis the bill in question. So may you kindly share light on that?
Yeah, sure, thank you for the question. I would call it the Cyber Crimes Bill and leave it at that. You don't need the cyber security in the name. The Cyber Crimes Bill would be what I call it.
Relates to the content, so yes, it will be dealt with in the content.
Well, no, because I think security actually is dealt with in the Protection of Personal Information Act. That's the Cyber Security Act, which is what... And I think that there has been confusion between POPIA and the Cyber Crimes Bill. And it's important that... And that's why I gave that example at the beginning of my presentation, because for me that clearly demonstrates how they work together. The one requires people to protect personal information to stop criminals. The Cyber Crimes Bill helps law enforcement catch the criminals and put them in jail.
Who is responsible for legislation in the department? She's looking at you with keen interest. Hello, Honorable Lebongo.
I'm not sure, because that act was passed by ourselves. Personal information.
Doesn't mean that we applied our mind to the same extent as they did.
No, but that one in the main, Jay, it deals with personal information.
Yes, as he did say.
But this one, it goes a bit broader than... broader and deeper. As it relates to what is in that act. And that act, as far as I'm concerned, it does give some... It does give, I think I debated on some, that this is what is going to happen to a person who does this and this and this. There are some sanctions in terms of that particular act, okay.
I think it's a
so how does he relate that act as it relates to only personal information, security, in terms of personal information? Here we're not speaking about security in terms of only personal information. So that's why you can't, from where I'm sitting.
Yes, no, good point. So you're right, the Protection of Personal Information Bill is just about personal information, which is one kind of information or data. It's a much broader concept. And the Cybercrimes Bill is about all data. But the Cybercrimes Bill doesn't require anyone to secure data. Personal information or data, the broader concept, it doesn't require it. So if we look then at the Protection of Personal Information Act, and I'm using the word POPIA because that's what the chairperson of the information regulator asked us to use. In there are about 10 offences. There are serious offences which are 10 years or 10 million rand, and there are minor offences which is one million and one year in jail. And they relate to specific things, though. It's like if you don't protect an account number or if you don't register the information officer with the regulator. Those are examples, or give false evidence. Those are crimes, but they're very small, they're very few. The rest is just unlawful.
But thank you for posing real challenges. And we always say we want to produce quality legislation. And your contribution is taking us in that direction. And thank you very much. And I guess we can excuse you, unless you yourself have something else to add.
Well, just to say thank you very much for hearing me.
You made an intervention which I don't think it was helpful as far as Honorable Bongo is concerned. He was talking about the broadness of his interpretation, and you cause a dilemma, whether is it broad or is it deep. The depth of it or the broadness of it. And he found himself in a situation similar to what King Chaka found himself when he was asked, how wide is the ocean? He says it's as wide as the sky.
Yeah, sure. I just want to find out furthermore that is he suggesting that we should put the information security requirement in this bill?
No, I'm not suggesting that.
What are you suggesting?
It's adequately dealt with in POPIA, the information security requirement, so it doesn't need to be here, which is why I'm suggesting we rename it the Cybercrimes Bill.
Yeah, but there is a... Like I said, that one deals mainly with personal information. And this one is broadly and deeper. So what are you suggesting we do? Because as we deal with this, we must be progressive in dealing with these issues.
Yes, so really only there's an information... And there are many other people in this room who are more qualified than me to talk about this issue, but... We really only require responsible parties to protect and secure personal information, not all information, because much information doesn't need to be secured. But obviously in a government context, there's state secrets. That certainly needs to be secured, but that's also not dealt with under POPIA. That would be dealt with under other legislation, but not this one. Unless I'm wrong, but...
And justices here, they will also put their heads together But you are taking us, you have taken us forward because we were limited in our thinking on the matter. And thank you very much.
Would it be possible that we get one person who was convicted around these issues, who's in the cell, so that he assists us to understand?
You can see if you can get young honorable members to engage in this session. It shows that you are very effective, and keep up the good work. Mr. Giles.
Thank you, Honourable Chair, Honourable Members. I hope to be brief so we can catch up a little bit. Really, just a couple of introductory remarks. The Department of Justice has excelled in the amount of engagement that has taken place before this bill has been introduced into the parliamentary process. We've been consulted for close to 3 years. My apologies. My name is Dominic Cole. I am the regulatory advisor to the Internet Service Providers Association of South Africa. So to continue, just to say that we had many issues with the bill originally, and then when we finally got to the version that had been submitted to Parliament, the written submission is short. That is not a reflection of a lack of interest. It's a reflection of what we believe to be the excellence of the department in engaging with stakeholders over the last 3 years. Perhaps the one exception to that is Chapter 3 on malicious communications, which I think is a more recent addition to the bill. And as I think the Chair and the Honourable Members have heard today, that is perhaps going to be the hardest work in the processing of this bill, is around the very difficult issues which are being debated around the world, around how we deal with cyberbullying, how we deal with revenge porn, how we deal with sexting. And the South African Law Reform Commission, Project 107, is currently seized with a review of the law in this matter regarding children and online pornography in particular, so the outcomes of that will be interesting. From an Internet Service Providers Association perspective, we have a very narrow submission which really relates to how ISPs, or as they are referred to in the bill, electronic communication service providers, how they interact with SAPs on a daily basis in the investigation and prosecution of cyber crimes in South Africa. We also have a role in cyber security. We have an Internet Service Providers Association search. We liaise with the Virtual Cyber Security Hub. And really, that's a developing competence within government. We have no issues with those provisions of the bill either. Very briefly, it's an incredibly important principle which is captured in Chapter 9 of this bill, which is set out in Section 52, Subsection 54, which really just restates a provision in Chapter 11 of the Electronic Communications and Transactions Act of 2002. And that provision is to the effect that an internet service provider or an electronic communication service provider is not required to monitor all the data flowing over its network. It's not required to actively seek out facts or circumstances indicating any unlawful activity over its network. And really, just to emphasize that that statement is a reflection of the reality of service provision. If you think that, I would say the biggest internet service provider in South Africa currently is Vodacom, perhaps Telkom, but Vodacom provides internet access to millions of people in South Africa who communicate in many different ways on a daily basis. It is absolutely impossible for Vodacom to monitor those communications flowing over its network to see if it can establish whether anything unlawful is happening. It's simply not realistic, and it is probably would be found not to be a justifiable limitation on the right to privacy contained in the Constitution. Our one issue which we'd like the honourable members to consider with regard to Chapter 9 is just a wording issue with regard to the fines imposed upon electronic communication service providers for contraventions of Section 52. Currently, it just states that if they are found guilty, they will be liable to a conviction on conviction to a fine of 50,000 rand. We would like that to, as is the normal case in legislation of this nature, to be reflected as a fine up to a maximum of 50,000 rand, not stating that there's no discretion on the part of the presiding officer as to what fine to impose. Another small technical item, if you look at the definition in the body of the bill regarding electronic communication service providers, it is slightly, subtly different to the one in the appendix to the bill dealing with proposed amendments to the Sexual Offences and Related Matters Amendment Act. So we've got, within the same bill that you're currently looking at, we've got two slightly different definitions of an electronic communication service provider. We don't have a preference for one or the other. We just ask that the committee apply its mind to whether it should be the same definition across all legislation. That's a principle which should be applied as well to other legislation such as the Protection from Harassment Act, the Maintenance Act, RECA, the Regulation of Interception of Communications Act, and also potentially the Film and Publications Act. So really a simple issue where there's slight wording differences there. The heart of the reason why we're here today is really about this thing called child pornography, or as I prefer to refer to it, child sexual abuse material, which is a very real issue in South Africa. You can read about successful investigations and prosecutions taking place almost on a weekly basis in South Africa. In Cape Town alone in the last week, there are two separate instances of criminal acts relating to the creation, possession, and distribution of child pornography or child sexual abuse material. The central submission which we'd like to bring to you today is that, and it really echoes what the very excellent Dr. Harrison stated earlier regarding should the provisions on revenge pornography be in the Film and Publications Act, or should they be in the Cyber Crimes and Cyber Security Bill, or should they be in the Sexual Offences Act? And we would echo that we don't believe that criminalizing provisions have any place whatsoever in the Film and Publications Act. The Film and Publications Act is administrative regulation. It is there to regulate the trade of distribution of films and publications. It's not there to take the place of SAPS, the National Prosecuting Authority. That is not the role of the Film and Publications Board. The version of the bill currently before this committee speaks to the deletion of Section 24 capital B of the Film and Publications Act. That is the specific section in that act which criminalizes the possession, creation, distribution, possession of child sexual abuse material. And we absolutely support that. It is correct that that provision be taken out because that crime is now going to be inserted into the Sexual Offences and Related Matters Amendment Act. But we don't believe that the bill goes far enough at this stage. If we're going to accept that this kind of criminal behavior is criminalized in legislation passed under the Department of Justice and Constitutional Development, it's dealt with by SAPS, who investigate and who arrest. It's prosecuted by the National Prosecuting Authority. We believe it's wholly incorrect for the Film and Publications Board to have any involvement whatsoever. And it's interesting that in the two bills are currently before Parliament. The Cyber Crimes and Cyber Security Bill is before this committee. The Film and Publications Amendment Bill is before the committee, Portfolio Committee for Communications. And there was obviously an awareness on the parts of the two departments that there were overlapping provisions, and there was a series of meetings which were held between representatives of the two departments to try and reconcile the fact that, for example, there are revenge porn provisions in the Film and Publications Amendment Bill, but there are also revenge porn provisions in the Cyber Crimes and Cyber Security Bill. And I just want to read through the outcomes of those meetings as they were presented to the Portfolio Committee on Communications earlier this year. So these are the outcomes of the meeting between DOJ, CD, and the Department of Communications. One, the regulation and criminalization of child pornography should not be dealt with in terms of the Film and Publications Act. The criminalization of child pornography should be dealt with in the Sexual Offences Act. The current tendency to deal with child pornography in the law which does not specifically relate to the criminalization of sexual offences hampers the further development of this important aspect and gives rise to a fragmentary approach. The regional court magistrates, the National Prosecuting Authority, and the South African Police Services have requested the Department of Justice and Constitutional Development to deal with child pornography coherently in a single law, being the Sexual Offences Act. South Africa is probably the only country in the world that deals with child pornography in a law that primarily deals with the classification of media. In almost all other countries, this category of offences forms part of their substantive criminal law. This is a position we agree with unreservedly, but it's, in our view, not sufficient for this bill to simply seek to repeal Section 24B. That's still going to create confusion for SAPS, for the NPA, for electronic communication service providers about how these crimes are investigated and prosecuted. The honourable members will have a copy of the written submission in their possession, and there is a table in that submission which sets out the definition of child pornography as it is currently contained in the Film and Publications Act, contrasted with the definition which is proposed to be included in the Cyber Crimes and Cyber Security Bill. And you will note immediately, honourable members, that the proposed definition to be included in the bill currently under consideration is extremely comprehensive. It is up to date. It takes in the latest comparative law. It is in line and compliant with all of South Africa's obligations in terms of Budapest, Lanzarote, other international conventions to which we are signatories. And it therefore can be no good reason in our minds that a definition which is deficient is retained in the Film and Publications Act. So we submit that the definition which is currently in the Film and Publications Act should be deleted. Should the Film and Publications Board need to have reference to a definition in its classification activities, it should have reference to the definition to be inserted into the Sexual Offences and Related Matters Amendment Act. We also request that the committee consider the deletion of Section 27 capital A of the Film and Publications Act, which requires internet service providers to register with the Film and Publications Board in order to facilitate the fight against child pornography. Again, there's a table, I think it's under paragraph 24 of the written submission, which contrasts the current subsection 27A2 of the Film and Publications Act against the proposed subsection 19A9 to be inserted into the Sexual Offences and Related Matters Amendment Act. And again, these two provisions are largely the same, but there's slight differences. We urge the honourable members to give due consideration to saying there's no need to duplicate these provisions. And they're not exact duplicates, they're slightly different. And it is these slight differences which have created massive issues for the magistrates, massive issues for SAPS, and for the National Prosecuting Authority in pursuing offences relating to child sexual abuse material. So the principles have been laid out in our submission, they simply haven't been followed through sufficiently.
Well, department say that you are forum shopping because you had the opportunity to make submissions along others, and they came to that position after considering your proposals and others, and then you realize that you didn't prevail there, then you want to reopen matters there. Would it be in our interest to reopen that?
Honorable Chair, we certainly are not forum shopping. These matters have been raised with the Department of Communications and the Portfolio Committee on Communications in respect of their deliberations around the Film and Publications Amendment Bill. These matters have been raised with the Department of Justice and the drafters of the Cybercrimes and Cybersecurity Bill. Subject to their confirmation, which the committee is, of course, able to get, we don't believe it's a case of the arguments having been rejected. We simply believe it's a case of they've been accepted. They haven't, and as reflected in the excerpts I read out, but what has been agreed on hasn't been implemented fully. So we wouldn't believe that the Department of Justice necessarily would have any objection to the fact that we're saying you've agreed on the principle, can we now apply the principle in full as opposed to partially? Chair, my apologies, I have a few more things to say. Thank you. You're very generous. I'll take one. Thank you. In conclusion, we support the bill. We believe it creates an improved legislative framework for lawful interaction between law enforcement authorities and electronic communication service providers. That interaction takes place on a daily basis. There is a very constructive relationship between the ISP community and SAPS. Around investigation and prevention of cybercrime, around education issues, we simply request from SAPS, and SAPS are in full agreement that any exchange of personal information or any assistance in investigation takes place within a lawful framework. The lawful framework currently under the Criminal Procedure Act is not sufficient. We believe that what is being set out in this bill is a vast improvement and will certainly assist in the investigation and prosecution of cybercrime where it takes place involving an internet service provider. We submit that there's an opportunity here to consolidate the law relating to child sexual abuse material. It's an incredibly important thing to get right, we believe, and we urge the committee, as we have done now, to follow through and to ensure that that opportunity is realized to its full extent. And then with regard to Chapter 3 and the various arguments have been raised, I think, Honourable Chair, you yourself noted that there may be reason to take the issues around harmful and malicious communications to a broader audience. We would absolutely support that. We think these are very, very tricky, difficult issues, which the lawyers can argue technicalities about, but as came through the presentation from the Digital Law Company, these are in fact very real issues being disproportionately felt by disempowered people. Thank you.
Are you an internet service provider to government or to the department?
No, Honourable Chair.
So we don't usually give them credit for you are well excused. Oh, you see now you, honourable members, you are now welcome to put questions not through the back door as you did before. Honourable Bongo, Honourable Majaki, Honourable Mathieu.
Yeah, thanks, Chair. Thanks for the presentation. You see, just like the very same issue I raised with the previous. And I do sympathize that we want to collapse generally these issues to you know, the cyberbullying, revenge porn, and so on. I think there are a lot of other things that we have to generally consider as we deal with this matter, which this bill must be able to cover generally. So, I see you did not get into the bill itself and make those specific amendments and so on. But I want you to, the bill, furthermore, and your contribution, you must be able to tell us, because now, it's like this subject, everyone who's presenting only knows a small portion of the subject and so on, and that is my worry. That is why I was suggesting to the chair earlier, maybe if you can go to the nearest prison and get somebody who was arrested on these issues and come here and brief the committee about the broad context of this. Because I'm looking at the previous speaker was speaking about the personal information, they call it pauper, whatever it is. But that one does not necessarily include issues like if you steal my building plan, what happens? Which law? Because I think this law must be able to also cover those aspects. If you steal my building plan, which is the case, as what was speaking, somebody did. And so he built the same house as mine. And I only know myself to have designed the house the way. So I think that this bill must be able to categorize those kind of things to be both unlawful, and there must be crime issues like if somebody take your litigation papers, if somebody take your academic work. You know, there was this law called is the copyright wherein you patent thing and so on, but that law, it does not necessarily deal with a person who steals the work of the work of the owner. It deals with the protecting the use by the person, the next person, without either authorization of this one. But if I steal it, more often than not, most academics' dissertation will be returned, but not all of them are found, because one will take a dissertation of somebody very far. But if you are not found, you stole the work. And some are found after some time when this work was stolen. So I'm looking at your contribution to it. I want you to comment generally on those issues, so that we're able to know what exactly. And Honorable Matthias was speaking about broadening. I'm trying to do that broadening, Honorable Matthias, because you're saying how broad is broad. You know? Issues of marketing tools, where do they fall? Electronic evidence. So, you know, those issues, because we need to do something that is able to bridge the gap to many, many other legislations that are related. So I think I'm sure we still have time, Chairperson, because it's just public hearings. We're still going to generally apply our minds, and we'll just want to say, let's continue to research, let's continue to dig deep until we find the solutions to the benefit of the people of South Africa. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you, Chairperson, and to thank the presentation of the Internet Association of South Africa. You know, listening to you, what I think I hear is not what is related to the purpose of the bill. because the purpose of the bill is to actually protect South Africans from harmful practices that are cyber related. But from where I'm sitting, what I hear is the worry about your industry finding itself in trouble. And that's why maybe you are actually saying this needs to be handled by the Films and Publications Act. The other one is supposed to be the Sexual Offences and Related Matters Act. But at the end of the day, I think as South Africans, it is our responsibility to actually have interest in seeing all South Africans protected. And whatever business that you find yourself in should be in such a way that it actually helps the country to actually be run properly, promoting peace, order, stability, and maybe security. But for all intents and purposes, it's good that you are actually interested in the bill, but at the same time, it's important also to understand the intention of the bill in terms of advancing the lives of South Africans. And if you look at it from that perspective, it will be very helpful for you to make some form of submission to us, taking into consideration the purpose of the bill.
I think the gentleman is most relevant because to make a presentation like this.
When I introduce, the reason I say the presenters must introduce themselves is to avoid the situation where they are just called gentlemen.
So I don't know what
you don't remember. It's late in the afternoon. Just reminding you.
Honourable gentlemen, Mr. Cull.
Honourable gentlemen, Mr. Cull. Oh, Mr. Cull, thank you so much. I think it's most relevant because he represents a sector which is chiefly responsible for what we're discussing. Without you, we'd not be talking about cybercrime, cyberspace, cybercrime, cyber security, isn't so? So you are the source of all evil. And on a lighter note, it's not meant to insult you. I'm making this point because a friend of mine from Zola in the Eastern Cape, when he's asked, he has never been to school, what is an internet? And he says his own language. The computer in Google and other. I don't know if you follow. So you've got a duty to be part of the broader campaign to educate our people and even to make internet, and not only internet as a platform, or as a platform, make available gadgets as cheaply or as freely as possible. My friend in Solo must have access to an iPad. He should be able to use it. Not only have it, but use it. That would be part of your social responsibility towards minimizing what is called digital divide. Now, Bridging. So, because you are the cause of all evil, in a sense that we are discussing cyber crimes and all of that, other than just a general statement you are making as you did, what specific measures should be in place? Over and above the request that I'm making to you that you must contribute in a very tangible way by availing gadgets, these instruments to our people so that as they engage with this matter, they know that this is what they need to use and to utilize to advance themselves and to better their conditions of living. What is it that in tangible terms you propose should be included in the bill? Thank you so much.
Intended consequence maybe that someone says the parliamentarians call presenters causes of evil. So the context is very important.
Well, I think that I provided the context in the sense that if it was not because of the availability of what is now called internet, would not be having a conversation like this about cyberspace, cybercrime, as well as cybersecurity.
As a public representative, use your language, but there must be a message that will not be
threat. Chair, if I may, I'm quite comfortable with the honourable source of all evil, if that helps you. if I may start there first. If you're going to construe the internet industry, and it's not just internet service providers, of course, it's also the Facebooks, the Googles, the platforms, the people who create the content. If you're going to refer to that as the source of all evil, then you may also want to refer to it as the source of all good. Because we know that this is a thing that can be used for good and it can be used for bad. Okay, so it can be used for advancement as well as for disadvantageous purposes. Then, to go back to the first question from the Honourable Member, yeah, this is slightly tongue-in-cheek, but you ask if we can go to the nearest prison and obtain some cyber criminals to speak to. And it made me think of two things. First is that, just reflecting that, I think the figures for prosecutions under the Electronic Communications Transactions Act, the conviction rate currently being achieved is 98%. So you should be able to find quite a lot of those criminals. But I don't think you'd need to go as far as the jails. Because I'm quite sure that on a strict reading of the law and the law around in the Electronic Communications and Transactions Act, Section 86.1, around unauthorized access, that there are plenty of cyber criminals sitting in this room. In this room. Okay. So it's that simple thing of you involved in a relationship with someone and their mobile phone is outside while they're in the shower. And you're suspicious about perhaps they're not being as close to you and you look through their messages. That's unauthorized access to information. For the purposes of Section 86.1 of the ECT Act, that's a crime. So... okay. If you go and look, if you have consent of your wife, then of course that is absolutely fine. If you go online and you look at the comment sections to big websites, News24, they've closed it down, a lot of them have closed it down. But there is no shortage of hate speech in the comment sections online. There's no shortage at all. Okay, that stuff needs to be dealt with, and that is ordinary people. That's not people sitting in jails. That's people on Twitter. That's people reacting to different things.
Why a crime can be committed unless there is an intention? Because those people don't have the intention to commit a crime, but they do something that may lead to a criminal action.
I take your point, but if I'm seeing someone, there's an article, and then someone comments on something which I perhaps don't like, and I then respond to that comment by calling them all kinds of racist epithets and names, I'm intending to do that. It's not negligent. It's not unintentional. It's an intentional defamation. It's an intentional bit of hate speech. And that's everywhere online. Okay, so I don't think we need to go to the jails. I think ordinary people have a very bad understanding of what it is and what is online crime and what is not. So, you know, you Honourable Member also talked about the broadness of this act. How does it relate to other legislation? And this is an incredibly broad act because it's essentially taking the criminal law as we've known it up until the age of the internet. And it's now saying that criminal law which works in the offline world doesn't always work in the online world. So now we need a piece of legislation which covers all of this criminal stuff that can happen online. And there's a huge amount. So this is going to be very broad legislation. It's going to touch on things like the copyright amendment bill, which is also up for deliberation at the moment, I think, before the Portfolio Committee for Trade and Industry. There was, I believe, in an earlier version of this bill, a Section 15 which related to criminal copyright infringement online. But that has been removed. And you would need to engage with the drafters, with the department, in order to understand the logic for that being removed and not being part of the bill at this stage. The bill deals with electronic evidence. On cybersecurity, the bill doesn't really talk, and this goes back to the previous presenter, it doesn't really talk about securing of information, it talks more about the structures. We're setting up a 24/7 emergency center. We're setting up these CSIRTs. There's the virtual cybersecurity hub in the Department of Telecommunications and Postal Services. They're going to be these rapid response teams in all industries and part of government, which CETA will also set up. So from a cybersecurity point of view, it's really about setting up the structures we will need for both a top-down and a bottom-up approach to cybersecurity. The honourable member who, I'm afraid, I'm afraid misconstrued the presentation in terms of was it an industry-centred presentation or not. It's not about the industry, it's about child sexual abuse material and making sure that those crimes are effectively prosecuted. We, as the internet service providers, as the telecoms, the Vodacoms, and the members of ISPA, we cooperate and deal with SAP's requests on a daily basis. Personally, I act as a liaison between SAPs and various service providers with regard to child pornography investigations. There's no desire to protect. There is a desire to consolidate the law within one set of legislation so that it can be equally applied and cogently applied and not the fragmentary approach at the moment. It's not the ISPs which are complaining about it. It's the National Prosecuting Authority, the regional magistrates, and SAPs which are complaining about it. This is not self-interest. So I urge you, Honourable Member, to re-engage with the written submission in that regard. It's not about self-interest. You, both Honourable Members also then said, well, where is ISPA? Where are you in the broader issues of bridging the digital divide? Everyone's got a role to play. What are the roles ISPA plays? ISPA's identified education as being crucial. So for 12 years, ISPA has been running a teacher's training program in rural areas in South Africa. More than, I can't get the exact number, I'm happy to give it to you, but more than 400 teachers trained. Last week in Durban, an awards event for the Super Teacher of the Year, where all the teachers are brought together at an event, and the one who has made the most progress in terms of internalizing and taking on board lessons is presented with the Super Teacher Award. It's about making an impact where it has the most impact, if that makes sense, which is in the classroom with the young people in rural areas. We talk about bridging the digital divide, and that's actually a critical issue when it comes to this bill. If you look at the Department of Telecommunications and Services and their plans under the South Africa Connect National Broadband Policy, we are intending to bring 3 to 4 million South Africans who currently do not have internet access online with affordable internet access in the next 5 years. The challenge, and the real challenge there, is it's difficult to bring them on board and for it to be affordable, but the real challenge is digital literacy. All of these people who come on board are naive users of the internet. They are easy prey for the criminals, and there are criminals out there everywhere looking for opportunities. If you look at what an ISP does to secure its network, you will realize that there are attacks against that network every single second of the day. By far, the majority of the budget is spent on securing it. We need to get into a mindset where when we, as a country, we reach our goals of bridging the digital divide, we bring new people who've never had the opportunities created by the internet, we bring them online, we need to make sure that they're actually equipped to deal with the threats which are online. And that's not part of this bill, but that needs to be part of a separate conversation.
You know, the level at which the debate is, from Mr. Giles there, from Mr. Mark here, just shows that we need more intense. We need more young people to be part of this debate, because that's the only way we can transfer skills. You can see, I'm not sure that the debate in the classroom is at this level. So we need to find a way of making these good presenters not friends of Parliament, but also make sure that the young students participate, begin to sensitize them, that the Roman Dutch books that they were reading are being left behind. We're moving into a new age, because we need our young people to keep abreast with the modern development. But thank you very much, and also for your public spirit, your passion, and not giving up, even if you think that the matters are concluded. There's nothing wrong in opening the debate and trying to persuade. You can see now you have kick-started a debate within the Department of Justice even before they go.
You said there is a clause that was put in the bill related to intellectual property, and that was removed. Is that what you said?
There was, Honourable Member, a Section 15, I believe, relating to criminal copyright, online copyright infringement, which I think has been removed. But you would that comes off my memory, so you would do well to check with the department.
You're suggesting that we request them to bring it back?
Certainly not. I'm supporting the fact that it is being removed. It was more an answer to the Honourable Member's question relating to how this bill relates to intellectual property and the theft of building plans. So to say at this stage it doesn't, but that I think is being dealt with under the Copyright Amendment Bill. Thank you, Honourable Chair, Honourable Members. Honourable Chair, if I may just have one parting remark. I think we can learn as much from our children as we can teach them. Our children understand the technology better than we ever will. We are dinosaurs. We missed that boat. But we still have values and experience and wisdom in the use of that technology, which we should be imparting to our children, and we should make no excuses in respect of our obligations in that regard. So it's a two-way communication. Thank you.
Need ethical and moral leadership. Thank you very much for marrying the two. It's very important, and you are well at it.
Can we check the aircon? It's very hot in this place. Yeah. Maybe it's because I've got a jersey on, but I don't know if other members. And the discussions are very amicable, so there's no hot air.
I think about the real problem. Honourable sir.
I know we're a bit late, but is it not possible to just allow 5 minutes to set up?
Someone is going to deal with it.
Thank you.
She's ODAC.
Oh, so it seems like an order.
But then the previous guy was the Sky Internet Service providers. So there's Africa Internet Solutions.
So you're definitely sure that she's from ODAC?
Yeah.
Thank you, Chairperson. good afternoon, honourable members and other people attending the committee. Thank you. I did not necessarily expect to be working on the cyber crimes legislation, because the world of cyberspace is not the primary interest of the Open Democracy Advice Center. But we did work extensively on the Protection of Personal Information Act, and we became familiar with information legislation, and via that group became involved in working on this legislation, and were able to participate in the technical committee who worked on consulting with the Department of Justice on this legislation. So that's the reason that I'm here. To say, I think that one of the things that we feel is that this legislation is necessary. We need this legislation in order to stop cyber crimes. Cyber crimes are not just the responsibility of law enforcement. They have to be the responsibility of everybody. One of the analogies people use is public health. If you have a group of people who are immunized against measles and one of them is not immunized, that compromises the health of the group. And exactly in the same way, we all have to be defended against cybercrime in order for the group to be protected against cybercrime. So we are very happy about that aspect of the legislation, and we think that it does work to protect our rights to privacy, to some extent our rights to freedom of expression, and of course our right to access to information. We'd like to try and focus on the second half of the bill, because I think you've heard a lot about the first half of the bill, and the majority of it we would completely agree with, so we don't need to repeat that. What I would like to do, and I would agree with the submissions made by Mr. Giles from Michelson's on the question of the use of the word unlawful. I think he's absolutely correct in that regard. And one of the ways you can see that is if you think about this section in a positive way rather than a negative way. So if you say a person is guilty of an offense, which is a cybercrime, what are we really trying to get to in terms of that offense? And the offense is really is if I secure access to a program or data held by a computer and that access is unauthorized and I do it deliberately. That's basically all we're talking about. So whether I come over and I steal your password or whether I use software to break into your phone, those are really the things that we are concerned about, and that's really what this bill is focusing on. But if you look at the way Section 2 is drafted, it's sort of drafted backwards, and it talks about you unlawfully and intentionally securing access, and then we only deal with the issue of entitlement or consent right at the end. So it's sort of like that, and then there's a lot of language in between. Whereas what we're actually trying to do is quite straightforward. So we propose redrafting of that section, and I have to say the same principle would apply to a lot of the other sections because they're also sort of drafted in a way backwards. What you want to do is say that you're guilty of an offense and then define the offense. And that's that's the way we usually work in criminal law. And I think that would really assist in making the language simpler and clearer, which is important. One of the sections I'd also like to draw your attention to, which I don't think anybody's spoken about, is the section which deals with software tools. And what that basically does is it says, you know, if you catch somebody and they've got a set of pick locks, the things that you use to open a lock if you're a burglar. Well, then that you can assume that the person is out intent to commit a crime, unless they're an actual locksmith and they've got a certificate and it's legit. What this section does is kind of tries to do the same thing. It says, look, if we catch you with these kinds of tools on you, well, there's got to be something that you're up to that's not kosher. You've got to be committing some kind of offense. And the problem with that, as I understand it, and perhaps some of the other people who come and talk to you might be able to assist further, is that in many instances, you actually, it's the equivalent, and I think we talked about putting two padlocks on your house. It's the equivalent of when you go around your house and you check that the doors are closed, and you try the lock. You open the door and you try it, and it's locked, and you, okay, I've locked up for the night. Now, that's exactly what your IT people are trying to do. They're trying to go around your system and just try the doors and make sure that they're locked. But in order to do that, they actually need to have tools on them to do that. You can't, you know, so you have to actually have a piece of software that does that. The problem is that looks very similar to the kind of software that a criminal uses, because that's also what a criminal does when they come to your house. They also try and open the door. So we're in this difficult position where you have people starting to say, well, should I even have the software? Because what happens if I'm accused of having the software and that I'm now going to commit a crime? When actually it's just one of the tools of the job if you're running a system.
What's that?
This is section 4, sorry. So that... It's called unlawful acts in respect of a software or hardware tool. So that's certainly something a number of people have been concerned about. In terms of sections 16 and 17, I think you've heard a lot about those sections. Inciting damage to property or violence, data messages which are harmful. And I think most of what everybody said I would agree with. I really, I can't think of much that I would disagree with. Also to just welcome the sections on revenge porn, although some colleagues of mine debate whether that's the right word to use, but those are good sections, so we don't have an issue with those. Just in terms of concrete recommendations, we would recommend that those sections are taken out and those issues dealt with under hate crimes, because you will have I hope soon the opportunity to address that legislation, and we have made submissions in that regard. So just in terms of that. The second thing, and what was intended here, was to deal with cyberbullying. Okay, so you take usually children, young people in schools, and there's cyberbullying. They become very unhappy. And there can be really very, very negative consequences. But this section doesn't really say that. And, I mean, I wonder if you, in reading the section, actually realized that it was dealing with cyberbullying, because it doesn't say that at the head. And it's not very clear from the section. In other jurisdictions, this is the cyberbullying is generally dealt with, and I'm particularly looking at the American example, is at a school level, and you would actually require schools to have a cyberbullying policy. And you would then have consequences which flow from that in the school setting. Because, you know, so many of these videos that we see are children in schools with their phones taking photographs or, you know, taking videos. And that's, you know, that can be a really concerning thing. But we're not sure that it's dealt with here. We could certainly look at some language if that would be of interest. I'm not sure if the committee wants to go there, but language in terms of making it clearer that there is a section dealing with cyberbullying. And, you know, there would also be the question of whether this committee could deal with that, because it's an education issue. So I wouldn't be able to be clear on...
You're welcome to come up with proposals and submit that to us.
All right, thank you. So let me move on from 16 and 17 and go to section 38. And my comrades from the Right to Know campaign mentioned the section. It's a section which tries to do a useful job. But I think also, as in the cyberbullying section, it's just not clear what it is supposed to do. And if you think about what it's supposed to do, it then starts to look problematic. And this is the issue that Mr. Hunter raised in terms of using both RICO and Section 205 of the Criminal Procedures Act to get evidence, which is related to phone calls and communications. So in terms of 205, you go to your local magistrates, you're a police officer, you need the evidence, that's where you go. Absolutely fine. In terms of RICO, you're intercepting a communications, there's a special RICO judge, that's where you go for that. But of course, what's ended up happening is that people go to magistrates to get things like metadata, so who you called, where you called from, what time you called, you know, in what area, because that's just as good for them as the actual content of the communications. So we've got this slew of subpoenas for that information, and we think it's in the region of 50,000 a year versus a much smaller number to the RICO judge. Now, we aren't applying the RICO protections for them in the magistrate's courts because the magistrates have to apply the Criminal Procedures Act. They can't come up with any more protections than that. But the RICO judge obviously can't deal with a huge number of requests for evidence. So there's a problem there. The helpful thing at this point is that there is a RICO reform process, and there is that whole discussion there about how to deal with RICO, and it's quite possible, I would think, to take this section into that process and fix these issues there. Because trying to fix them here seems very complicated, and I have to say I can't think of a way or a useful way to sort of do it here, because then you'd have to get into Section 205 and then it would become, you know, it would become a bit of a nightmare is a good word. Thank you, Chair. So that's one of the sections that we think should be kicked to touch, so to speak. A second section which we'd like to draw your attention to, and I'm afraid, again, I don't necessarily have very helpful ideas about how to fix it now and here, is Section 57. And Section 57 is basically the national key points for computers. So what it says is that you are in, and if you think about how the National Key Points Act works, let's say that you run an oil refinery. And yes, it's a business and you're making profit and it's in the private sector, but you're obviously creating an enormous risk. I mean, an oil refinery exploding kills a lot of people. So what the National Key Points Act does is it says, okay, we're going to apply specific security measures, which we're going to require you to do because you're a national key point. So you've got to have guards that are trained, you've got to have fences, you've got to put all of those provisions in place, because in running your business, you're creating a risk. Now, that's exactly what we're trying to do here, is to say, well, obviously, it's not just buildings and oil refineries. It's computers. And if you run a computer system, which is essential to national security, or it has implications for public health, or any one of a number of reasons, then shouldn't you have to secure that system? I mean, that seems reasonable. But of course, it's what's different is that in order to show you that I'm complying with the national key points, I can walk you through my building, and I can show you the certificates of my guards, and I can prove to you that I'm complying with all the rules and regulations. To do that with a computer, I actually have to let you in. I have to let you into my computer to see what the safeguards are that are there. And the way that the bill deals with this is to say, well, we could send an auditor in to check. Now, we all know what an auditor is, or certainly as a non-profit organization, I know what our auditors are, who are the people who come and check that there's a paper trail in place, and they are accredited, and there's a professional body, and it's all, you know, that's how you know who an auditor is. Now, there's no equivalent sort of person who comes and does an audit of your system. So what we're just not clear on is what that would look like. And then the second problem is why from there that the, and it's the State Security Agency who are responsible for this, why from there it's necessary to be able to declare things like municipal computers a national key point. Because then you're operating inside government, and you're operating in terms of the minimum information security standards and the various other pieces of legislation that apply, PFMA, municipal, NFMA, and all the rest of it. So what would that look like? And wouldn't that end up being the case that you're then telling municipalities, for it as an example, that they have to put systems in place, but there's no requirement that you fund that? So then you end up in a situation where you're telling people that they have to spend money, but then the question is, where does that money come from, and what is that budget? And then the question of just, isn't that really overbroad? And I think that's also something that's come up in terms of overbreadth. And I've listed for you, just for ease of reference, the sections in the Constitution that set out which institutions that this would apply to. And I mean, it includes things like the South African Library for the Blind, which
municipalities are an integral part of government.
Yes, sir.
And key points areas would be within the municipal areas.
Yes.
So how do you separate?
That's a very good question. That's the question that I have. It's easier when it comes to things like the Rural Housing Loan Fund or the Robben Island Museum. I mean, you just don't need to ever declare those critical information infrastructure. Must be so. If you have a municipality, I mean, particularly if you look at water systems, I mean, that's always one of the issues around cyber terrorism, is that perhaps cyber terrorists would be able to get into your infrastructure systems. But the question of, and I think it's not just that, it's then also the question of concurrent powers, and is this committee empowered to make legislation which has that kind of effect? So I think there may be a problem there. I think there might be various different ways of solving it, but one of the things that I do know is that the critical infrastructure legislation is also pending, and that is going to be dealt with. And it seems like if you've got to deal with critical information infrastructure and critical infrastructure, well, you're dealing with critical infrastructure in both instances, and might that not be the better place to deal with it there? Because then you can iron out some of these wrinkles in that section. So in essence, to close, we would recommend that sections 57 and 38 be diverted into the other processes, which are underway as we understand it, and that in terms of sections 16 and 17, that those again be struck, and the hate crimes legislation deal with those, and that sections 2 and 4 be redrafted. Thank you.
Thank you very much for the presentation, Honourable Member. Honourable Horn.
Thank you, Chair. Back at the issue of the unlawfulness, and I've obviously had some time to think about it further now. So I just would like Ms. Tilly to comment on the stance she and the presenter from Michelson's has taken, that it's not proper to use the unlawfulness as a requirement per se. To say that, I think, and I'm really now addressing his concerns, that when, for example, somebody has to preserve data and such an institution is not doing it in a lawful manner, wouldn't, even though it's technically then acting in an unlawful manner, wouldn't the fact that there's no intent then
to commit a crime in any event negate the fact that technically they, such an institution or person is acting in an unlawful manner, so that so I just need to understand the real objection to specifically using the term unlawfulness, in the sense that it's always linked to the intent to also commit a crime. And why then there's such an objection to including it in the wording of the of this statutory crime. Thank you.
I appreciate some of when you're on section 38, you gave some direction, what you suggest we should do. But all others, I didn't see that in your mission. You didn't say, okay, you would prefer it be that way. Are you saying that it should be removed, like others did, on section 16 and 17? You come up with some arguments, but you don't say what's the way forward. And secondly, it's very helpful to do that, so that we consider it. If you don't mind, as the chairperson said, you could resubmit your proposal just to cover those portions and say we suggest this. And this will be the advantage of it being the landlord. I'm sure the secretary would help us attach that to your research. I don't really agree with you on some of your arguments, which are very good, but I'm waiting for that. For your and you show cause and thereafter you suggest the about this cyber this pushing it to RICA, I'm not sure if it is correct, but I still maintain on the question of two padlocks are better than one. I still maintain on that. I'm not yet convinced that you need only one padlock and the other one in another room, and so on. I think, but you need to in your say this is the position and it will have here and there after meeting. Right. Thank you very much.
I think you're persuaded the honourable member. Thank you, Chair. Yes, Mr. Horn, I do try to deal with it in submission. I think one of the things is that unlawfulness is often used in the context of administrative law. So when you are the state and you act, you have to act in terms of a law. If you fail to act in terms of a law, that is unlawful. It's not necessarily criminal at all, but it is reviewable and stands to be set aside. So that's the general use of unlawfulness. Using it here in a criminal context is difficult because what you want to say is there's an actus reus and there's mens rea. If you're in a situation where you're only talking mens rea, then you're confusing me because I need to see an actus reus. If what I do every day is the actus reus and the only element of the crime that you have is mens rea, that's a problem. So what we're saying is that you need to have actus reus and mens rea in the situation, and what you don't have because of the framing of the section is actus reus.
What section?
That is in the discussion about unlawfulness, so that's
okay.
Section 2.
Okay.
And that's where we suggest you turn it other way around so that it's positive, so that the crime is where I try to hack into your computer. So that's the crime. So where I said that you're guilty of the offense if you secure access to the computer, rather than saying there it is unlawful if you do these things, and then right at the end say, and you have the unlawful intention.
You are affecting the court, aren't you?
Sorry. Well, thank you. That's very kind of you.
As a corporate lawyer now, I can say it's more than that. Yeah. Thank you very much. You are well excused. You have persuaded the members.
Thank you.
Others have even folded the hands.
Well, might be
bad. Digital forensics, are they here?
Yeah.
Thank you, well done.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Chair, and thank you, Honourable Members, for giving me the opportunity to present today. My name is Jason Jordan. I'm a practicing forensic scientist working within the field of digital evidence and multimedia evidence. I'm currently in independent practice, and prior to being in independent practice, I've been in law enforcement for most of my career. Fundamentally, that means I like to catch cybercriminals. That's what I've done for the last 20 years. You know, I think it's an important thing for our society, and I'm actually very grateful that we now have this bill currently before Parliament after so many deliberations. Now, for me, as somebody who's been engaging with cyber criminals and catching them for most of my career, obviously we're limited by the legislation that we have at our disposal. You know, before we had the ECT Act, you know, we were basically dealing with common law fraud issues. It was a very sort of haphazard way of dealing with cyber criminals. And the ECT Act actually gave us a much better framework to work with it. But it wasn't necessarily perfect, and it did have limitations. The other thing is South Africa took a very progressive stance in terms of becoming a signatory to the Budapest Convention on Cybercrime. And what's nice with this particular bill before Parliament currently is that this will now give us the opportunity to actually ratify that treaty, which I feel is quite important in terms of addressing transnational crime. And we must remember that cybercrime is fundamentally a transnational crime. For example, most of the phishing attempts that we see on a daily basis, the things that have been targeting the banks, most of these have their origins not in South Africa, but they form part of much broader transnational organized crime syndicates. Now, what's very important in addressing all of these cybercrimes that are introduced into the bill is that we need digital evidence. At the end of the day, myself as a forensic practitioner, I need to have digital evidence to basically build a case and be able to present that case with the assistance of the prosecution services in court. And then a judge or magistrate had to deliberate on the evidence that we present and make a finding on that. Now, not only is digital evidence relevant in prosecuting the offences that have been proposed in terms of the cybercrime and cybersecurity bill, but the majority of criminal offences that we deal with in South Africa on a daily basis have some element of digital evidence in there. Whether we're investigating a fraud case where you know, documentation has been altered, or we're dealing with various types of sexual offences, digital evidence has a role to play. Even in things like robberies and cash in transit heists or murders, we're fundamentally using digital evidence through positioning of a person by way of their cell phone and all those kind of issues. Now, for us to make effective use of digital evidence in courts of law in South Africa and around the world, we need to make use of digital forensics to effectively deal with that evidence. Now, digital forensics is a defined, established forensic science that deals primarily with digital evidence. So just like any of the other forensic sciences, For example, forensic chemistry obviously deals with chemistry issues. If you're dealing with ballistics, you're dealing with physics. Digital forensics is effectively an extension of computer science and computer engineering in dealing with digital evidence. Now, as with all of the forensic sciences, digital forensics is dependent on the competencies of the practitioners, the minimum standards and qualifications, so that the courts can ultimately rely on the evidence that these specialists bring before them in terms of prosecuting offenders. Now, we have seen a significant move internationally towards improving the quality of digital forensics practitioners as well as other forensic science practitioners around the world, specifically in places like the United States, where there have been egregious violations of standards in the forensic science system where people have actually ended up prosecuting innocent persons that should never have been prosecuted. And I think as a society, we have a strong sense of justice that we need to do the right thing. You know, the sort of old adage of it's better for 100 guilty people to walk free than for one innocent person to be imprisoned, I think has to take a role in here. Now, when it comes to the field of digital forensics, we've actually seen the importance of standards come into play through the development of international ISO standards, which ironically have been driven from South Africa. South Africa has played a fundamental role in developing digital forensic standards through international standards organizations that have now been adapted and adopted worldwide. But despite the fact that South Africa has played a leading role in the development of these ISO standards, we do have a problem in terms of the current capacity of our digital forensics practitioners in South Africa in terms of dealing with digital evidence. Now, the research that I've conducted as part of my master's thesis and that's extending now into my doctoral thesis is that currently when it comes to digital forensics practitioners in South Africa, we generally don't meet the minimum required standards in terms of competency training and qualifications. One of those problems is that our knowledge base is based around the use of tools. So we have vendors that supply various tools for us to utilize in our profession, and these vendors will come and provide training courses, and we become proficient in the use of the tool. But that doesn't necessarily make us competent forensic science practitioners, or doesn't make us competent in actually interpreting the digital evidence that we're dealing with. So I'd like to use this as an analogy. I know a lot of accountants. You know, as somebody that's been in law enforcement for a long time and my field of practice was in white-collar crime and commercial crime, I dealt with a lot of forensic accountants. And I realized that all accountants are really, really good at using Excel, way better at using Excel than I ever will be. But does that mean that if I go on a course to practice to use Excel and I now become a proficient Excel user, does the fact that I know how to use Excel now make me an accountant? Or the fact that I go and do a first aid course, does that now make me a doctor? And I think that's the problem that we currently have in South Africa when it comes to this field of forensic science, is that the vendors have created an environment, and it's not just in South Africa, it's an international problem, where the tool is more important than the proficiency of the person using it. Now, that would be like going to a doctor and because he uses a sharper scalpel than the next doctor, that's a better doctor. You know, the sort of, I've seen rural doctors, and I grew up largely in the Transkei, that could do amazing things with very limited resources. That didn't make them less competent doctors because they didn't have all the fanciest tools and equipment. So I think it's very important that we address this issue because it's leading to bad interpretations in terms of where we're going and the kinds of evidence that we're dealing with. Now, the simple reality is, and it is documented quite extensively in my written submissions, is that the current quality of digital forensics examiners in South Africa doesn't meet required minimum standards of training, competencies, and education. Now, this for me is very problematic because if we look at the other branches of forensic science that we rely upon daily in our court system, they do have to be competent. So if I want to present DNA evidence in court, I need to have somebody who at least have a bachelor's degree or a master's degree in biochemistry or genetics or one of the hard sciences to come and present evidence because they need that fundamental knowledge. If I want to present ballistic evidence in court, for example, dealing with terminal ballistics or ballistics in flight, I generally need to have a physics qualification because I need to understand the calculations. I need to be able to do all of these complex scientific issues. But when it comes to digital forensics, we don't have that, and that's something that needs to be addressed. Now, I truly believe that this bill gives us some opportunities, but before I get to the opportunities that this bill presents us, a lot of what I'm talking about in terms of the problems has a real human effect, because in the work that I've done over the last 20 years, I've had the opportunity to see examiners, digital forensics practitioners, who've made fundamentally blatant errors in interpretation that have actually compromised people's lives. So cases, for example, where somebody in the private sector does a digital forensics job and that leads to that person being prosecuted, but the person who's done the forensic examination has actually no clue what they're doing and they've completely misinterpreted the facts, and that person ends up being arrested, ends up going through the whole system, and ultimately the court case gets dropped when the prosecution realizes that there's no case. Now, oftentimes, and I say this as somebody who's served in the state for many, many years, the state usually gets the short end of the stick saying, you know, the problem is always with the state. The problem is always in the competency in the state. And unfortunately, the reality is when it comes to digital forensics, yes, there are problems in the state, but I can guarantee you now there is more training and development taking place at a state level when it comes to digital forensics than there is in the private sector. And I've seen that for myself, having engaged with both the Hawks and the South African Police Service, and SARS for that matter. The problem that we have is that it's too easy for somebody to just say they're a digital forensics practitioner. Anybody that knows a little bit about IT can hang their shingle up and set up a business and say, we're doing digital forensics. And unless you know better, the old adage of the one-eyed man is, you know, in the land of the blind, the one-eyed man is king, realistically applies here. So I think it's very important that we address this. And the bill actually does address this to a certain extent. And we've introduced some sections, specifically Clause 24, which I think is really cutting edge and really puts South Africa at the leading edge in terms of how we deal with digital evidence and the processes around cybercrime investigation. There are only currently two countries in the world that I know of at the moment that have similar provisions. One is the Netherlands, which through their Ministry of Justice and Legislation has created the Netherlands Register for Court Experts, which regulates who may or may not testify in court as an expert witness, which includes this. And we also have the United Kingdom, which has the Office of the Forensic Science Regulator that falls under the Home Office that deals with who may be recognized as a forensic scientist. Now, in that context, Clause 24 is a great piece of, a great section in principle, because it basically addresses how we're going to investigate cybercrime and how we're going to improve the use of digital digital evidence in all sorts of crimes. And as I say, I think the Department of Justice really has to be commended on the drafting of this particular section because it is something innovative that we don't necessarily see in international law. But from a practitioner point of view and from a legal point of view, I do have some concerns. The first concern that I have is Clause 24 talks about the development of standard operating procedures. Now, this is a new concept in South African law. We don't have any other pieces of legislation that I'm aware of, and I'm not a lawyer by profession, so if there is one, I will concede the point. But I'm not aware of any other legislation which compels the introduction of standard operating procedures on anything. In our South African legal system, when we have subordinate legislation, we issue regulations. And my personal view is that that is an issue that may potentially cause some legal confusion. The second area of concern that I have with regards to Clause 24 is that currently it only applies to the state. Now, I think that is a slight oversight because, as some of the previous presenters have mentioned, there is a lot of work around cybercrime and cybersecurity that's happening outside of the state environment. The banks may, for example, initiate an investigation into a hack into their system. They do an internal investigation, and ultimately that gets handed over to the South African Police Service. But they have already collected evidence, and the South African Police Service and then ultimately the National Prosecuting Service or Prosecuting Authority have to rely on that evidence going forward. Now, why are we placing a higher onus on the state in terms of dealing with the evidence than the people that deal with the evidence in the first place? So I do believe, from a practical point of view, if we have a situation like this, whether it's a regulation or an SOP, it needs to be applicable to everybody. I'm a very practical person, so I felt it was prudent not to just come and highlight concerns, but also come and make proposed suggestions on where I think we could address this better. And I think in terms of Clause 24, I'd like to retitle it and fundamentally call it Regulations Regarding the Investigation of Cybercrime and the Identification, Preservation, Examination, Analysis, and Interpretation of Digital Evidence, which brings it in line with the international ISO standards. I would also replace all references to standard operating procedures with regulations. And then I would also add in a clause 24.1c, which would basically say that these regulations would also now be applicable to any person or organization that's investigating an offense in terms of any law or in terms of this section, or any offense which is facilitated with the use of an article. So fundamentally, these regulations would then be applicable to every single person within South Africa that had some kind of responsibility towards digital evidence. Now, for me, that's important because ultimately, the National Prosecuting Authority will make a decision on prosecuting persons. And yes, I heard the previous speaker in terms of saying how good our prosecution rates are in terms of prosecution in terms of the ECT Act. But what we also don't necessarily realize is how many cases we don't prosecute on the ECT Act because the evidence is just bad. And the prosecutors realize that the evidence is bad and decline to prosecute. So fundamentally, because we have a situation that a lot of digital evidence is dealt with first in the private sector before it gets to the state, by introducing regulations that deal with digital evidence at the private sector level, it will actually ensure that the quality of the evidence that we have coming through the system as it moves through the SAPS or through the DPCI and it gets to the NPA will actually be valuable evidence that the presiding officers in courts of law can actually rely upon. The second clause that I'd like to focus on is Clause 51, and that deals with the presentation of an affidavit as proof of facts. Now, this section is fundamentally in line with Section 212 of the Criminal Procedure Act, and it's a mechanism basically designed to speed up trial processes, effectively where a forensic scientist or some kind of specialist can do their lab work, do all this sort of very technical scientific work, and then present that evidence by way of a sworn or affirmed affidavit in court, and that evidence can be accepted as prima facie proof of an event. As a practitioner, while I was in the employ of the state, I made use of Section 212 extensively, so I'm very comfortable with how it works. But I do have, again, some concerns with how we've looked at Clause 51 currently. My first concern is that when we define the skill areas required for somebody to give evidence about digital evidence and digital forensics, the definition is written so broadly that literally anybody with some kind of IT course behind them could potentially go and testify in court as an expert witness. So I could have somebody who's literally just come out of school, has gone and done an A-plus certification, which is a basic technical how to repair computers course, and come and now testify in court as an expert witness to a judge or a magistrate that may not know any better and interpret evidence the wrong way. And again, I've seen this on cases where that's exactly what's happened. The other concern that I have is that Clause 51 currently only applies to the state. So the provision of being able to issue a sworn affidavit is applicable only to the state. I think it should be applicable to all forensic practitioners. The third concern that I have is that there's no requirement in Clause 51 for the practitioner submitting these affidavits to have actually fully documented the methodologies they've used. Now, I believe this is in contrast to Section 212 of the Criminal Procedure Act, which actually requires the person making the affidavit to fully document the scientific methods that they've used in reaching their conclusions. So I believe we just need to bring this clause in line with what we already have within the Criminal Procedure Act. And then also we have the other concern that I have is that the right to cross-examine that person is not automatically allowed. In other words, it has to be authorized by the magistrate or the judge. And if the magistrate or the judge chooses not to authorize it, then that evidence is just accepted as prima facie evidence. I have a slight concern about that, because the only way I could ventilate whether that person was competent is to have the right to cross-examine. I made a few recommendations for Clause 51, and I'm cognizant that I have exactly 1 minute and 10 seconds to go. So I would like to amend Clause 51.1.2, basically to say that this section should be amended to say, possesses relevant qualifications, expertise, and experiences defined in the regulations issued in terms of Section 24. So coming back to Section 24. Yes, that's correct, Honourable Member. So basically, as per my previous submission, we would take standing orders, replace them with regulations, and one of the regulations that would be covered would be the minimum competency and qualifications. Now I have been working with the Department of Justice in terms of reviewing proposed standard operating procedures in preparation for the promulgation of this bill as an act, and I can already assure the Honourable Members of this committee that those provisions are already there within the proposed situation. So this will just help clarify it for court purposes. Sorry, Honourable Chair. Not a consultant. I was actually appointed by the Deputy Minister to serve on an advisory board to assist the Department of Justice with this bill because of my expertise in this field. But just from a practical point of view, I'm also doing it pro bono because I really, like I said, I just like to catch bad guys, and this gives us the opportunity to do this much better than we've been doing in the past. Thanks, Honourable Chair. I won't leave all 3 minutes, but I do thank you for the indulgence. I would amend Clause 51.1.3 to basically say that has established such fact by means of a scientifically validated and documented examination or process, which is fully documented in the affidavit, that will bring this section in line with Section 212 of the Criminal Procedure Act. I would also amend Section 51.1.1 to basically say, or a digital forensics practitioner in the employ of a private body by notice of the Gazette. So in other words, somebody that was in the private sector doing digital forensics work could be allowed to submit an affidavit as prima facie evidence, provided it had been approved by the Minister and gazetted in the Gazette. And then I would introduce a clause 51.5d, which would say the opposing party may request that the person making the affidavit submit themselves for cross-examination. In conclusion, Honourable Members, I do believe that my proposed amendments will actually enhance our ability to make use of digital evidence and facilitate our ability to prosecute not just cybercrime, but all crimes relating or relying on digital evidence. Effectively, this will strengthen our ability to see justice done. And for me, I, this is an area that I'm very passionate about. I have been responsible for putting a lot of cyber criminals behind bars. And the last guy that was convicted from an investigation I did received a 22-year jail sentence. I sleep very comfortably at night knowing that I have put the right... I can assure the Honourable Members that he's certainly not here. But I can sleep very comfortably at night knowing that individual committed crimes against the citizens of this country and is receiving the just punishment that he deserves, and hopefully some kind of rehabilitation. But having been inside prisons as an investigator and interviewing inmates, the conditions in our prisons are not a place that I believe any one of us would want to go. And I want to know that I want to sleep soundly at night that when my investigation results in the imprisonment of somebody, that it's the right person who's there and not somebody who's innocent. Because I can think of no bigger travesty in justice anywhere in the world where an innocent person is prosecuted for a crime they didn't commit. The other reason why I think these amendments will help us is that cybercrime is fundamentally a transnational crime. By introducing this bill, by promulgating this bill, it becoming an act, South Africa will be able to ratify the Budapest Convention. The evidence of our investigators, the evidence of our forensic practitioners, will help our brothers and sisters in other countries around the world rely on the evidence that we gather to assist them in their investigations, just as our investigations are reliant on the evidence that they collect in their jurisdictions. And I would like to submit to this honorable committee that these amendments would simply align us with international best practice and ultimately help us not make just South Africa a safer place and a more just place, but also help the broader world to help combat the scourge of cybercrime. Thank you.
Thank you very much, honorable members, honorable Sort, honorable Bongo, honorable Nguyen, in that order.
No, Chair, I'm just very concerned because earlier the previous speaker said there could be some potential criminals here, and here we have someone that's such an expert, so he may well prosecute some of us here. It would have been a nice thing. So we've got privilege. Okay, thank you, Chair. No, I'm very impressed with the input and your expertise in this field. But what I don't understand is if you're engaging in the drafting of the bill, I presume you made these suggestions to the drafting process. And so they make eminent sense to me. But I just don't understand if you are helping with the drafting of the bill, where is the disjunction come in? Did you not get favour with those particular issues, and are you now trying to persuade us? It makes sense. I'm sure the department will respond later as well. But the fact that you are seeing it from one side, criminal prosecution, is very valid, but obviously there's the other side of protecting innocent people and innocent, vulnerable people, and we've got presenter right at the end. It's a pity, I don't know if Mr. Ito is here, we've got a presentation of someone that was victimized. And because you're involved in the drafting, you'll probably see that submission, where there's a total abuse of process by a civil process and then getting a civil order, then getting a criminal prosecution. I mean, that is disgraceful. So you see the scope for abuse that can take place. And it seems the expert there is exactly what you're saying, was not a proper expert. But it was an employer that discriminated against an employee and used every field of law. And he says here that the lack of expertise and understanding of computers, electronic evidence, and cybercrime generally in the SAPs. That was his experience. So there is another side to it that we've got to be aware of, and so we've got to strike that right balance between the two. But I think the issue, the point that you make about ensuring... In fact, that submission supports you in ensuring that there needs proper evidence and your experts must be proper. And I think that's a very strong submission that you make. So we'll look, from our side, we'll be looking very carefully at the submissions that you make, but because it does make a lot of sense to us. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Chair, and thanks for the presentation. I think it does assist in terms of getting zooming in into the sections themselves and who will generally interact with those as we are gathering more research. But my interest, and I want you to comment on that, the research shows that in South Africa this cyber crime is very high, but it furthermore says the whole of Africa. So maybe if you can comment on work done in terms of, because I know that the countries in the West are generally specializing on this matter, and there is this network of these people. So with your experience from where you were working and being part of this bill, I think it will assist, but what will be your view in terms of what other networks are we going to have in the continent to look at this crime and fight it directly. I think you all want to contribute on that one. Thank you, Chair.
Very much, I appreciate it. It's a bit late in the day.
So thank you very much. Let's start with 24.1. You want to bind, is your problem with B? Is the question that the person is authorized by law, is that your question? Because I don't think that why your provision is actually covered in B. Do you need a C? And which you have suggested. And if so, you think that it won't fit in there. You'll probably explain that. Secondly, there is 51.1.2. Problem I have, the possession of relevant qualifications, to be a bit vague. Don't you think that there has to be some kind of definition of what you mean relevant qualification in the definition of terms? And if so, what would you suggest would be the correct definition there? Also, I understand the complexity of the thing, but you need to explain on the question of 51.1.3 scientific validated and documented examination process. What I'm trying to say here is it's a bit vague. An ordinary juristic judge or whoever, unless a clear definition is put in there on that scientific.
An ordinary not judge.
Well, I assume that the judge who will be there will be understanding. Otherwise, if it's an ordinary judge or a lawyer, it doesn't fit in to be there. Anyway, I think it would help to clarify that part of. When you say scientifically validated, it's subjective, isn't it? What do you mean? What do you exactly? Okay. Same is 51.1. A digital forensic practitioner in the employ of a private body. By notice. Now, are you suggesting that when investigating the matter, let us take an example, I would need somebody like you and say, can you assist me in the investigation of this case because of your knowledge of the particular field, without necessarily being a member of the police? Is that what is being suggested? Okay. Thank you very much. That's about all, sir.
Thank you, Honourable Chair, and thank you, Honourable Members, for the very concise questions and I think very pertinent and to-the-point questions, and I'm welcome the opportunity to clarify. With regards to the question from the first honourable member that had asked regarding the issue of due process and things along those lines, so I'll first clarify my involvement with this process. I became involved with the Department of Justice after the bill had gone out, I think the second iteration of the bill had gone out, in which case many of these things had already been ventilated, so this is something that was dealt with separately. So I have had discussions with the Department of Justice around this. They're just not in this because it had already gone out, if that makes sense. With regards to the concerns, the abuses, I think the case that you mentioned, I'm aware of as part of my research and preparing for this. I'd looked at that case as well as a number of other cases. And in this particular case, there was a complete failure, a complete breakdown of interpretation of digital evidence. So you had from the company appointing somebody to now help build a case against this individual who was completely not qualified or competent to testify around fundamental issues. Now, I'd like to make light of this. I know it's a very serious proceeding, but I'm somebody who's been in IT for most of my adult life. You know, I started as a young kid with computers. I've grown up with computers. But for most people, when they hear that you're good with IT, the first question is, like, can you fix my printer or my computer at home doesn't work? Can you come and fix it? But at the same token, we also hear people say that, oh, you're good with computers, so this digital forensic stuff, that's a computer thing, so you must obviously know how to do this as well. And that's not the case. This is a very specialized and very, very focused discipline which requires specialized skills. Now, in this particular instance, you had a general IT person playing the role of an expert and who fundamentally and blatantly misinterpreted the evidence. And I'm not saying that it was done necessarily deliberately. It could have been done because that person just simply didn't know that they were wrong. And one of the professional adages that we have in digital forensics is I need to have the professional maturity that when I get to a case dealing with something that I don't know, I need to say, because again, my duty is to the court, that I don't know. I can't make stuff up. I can't pretend to be all-knowing because no human being can do that. I need to know where the limits of my knowledge are. In this instance, you had an amateur doing something that compromised this person's investigation. It then went to another level where there was now a private practitioner coming in on the defense side to now try and counter this person. But that person, again, for all of their good requirements, also didn't meet the necessary minimum requirements in certain areas. Then the police got involved and other aspects of the investigation, and they it got worse there. So it's going to sound funny, but having been in law enforcement for most of my life, you know, this adage of my blood is blue will always. It doesn't mean I'm a blue ball supporter. It just means that I'm an ex-cop. You know, for me, justice is very important. It's important that we do the right thing. And in this instance, everybody along the chain failed this individual, and there were consequences for him professionally. You know, his reputation was ruined. He'd been arrested. He'd been locked up. He went through this whole legal process, and ultimately he was just thrown out of court when the prosecutor realized there was no case. And that's just one of several cases that I've come across during my research where people have been wrong in their interpretations and had a very real human cost. And I have a problem with that because, like I said, that type of damage to a human individual is very difficult to overcome. With regards to the second member who's now stepped out, but I don't speak recorded, so I'll cover that. The question was asked about the work that's been done on the African continent, and I know through the African Union there is some work being done in this area within SADC. So we have the Southern African Regional Chiefs of Police Cooperating Organization is doing some work in this regard. We have the EARPCO group, which is the East African Regional Chiefs of Police Cooperating Organization. We have the similar thing in West Africa. We are starting to have these mechanisms in place, and we're starting to align our legislation. But what we are finding is that a lot of these countries are still coming to South Africa to ask for assistance because we have developed a certain level of expertise. And ironically, one of the reasons why I left state service was that I was getting engaged with a lot of work in other African countries through Interpol and through the United Nations to actually help these countries develop their capacity. So I think with this legislation, I mean, and this will be probably the most comprehensive cyber legislation on the continent, South Africa has an opportunity to really play a leading role in making Africa a secure continent and being a leading role player in cybersecurity and cybercrime fighting in Africa. And that's something I'm very passionate about. I want to share an example of why I'm passionate about this. I do a lot of training internationally. Earlier this year, I was giving training to the FBI and Secret Service and a whole group of law enforcement officials from around the world. And there was a gentleman from the Republic of Ghana who was there at the same training course. And after I'd presented my training course, he came up to me to thank me and shake my hands and say he was so proud that there was somebody from Africa standing and training at this international training event. And then he asked me the strange question, so where do you live in America now? And I'm like, I don't live in America. I live in South Africa. I live in a little seaside city called East London in the Eastern Cape. And I think that was quite a nice experience because he could turn around and say, but Africa has the expertise. So we don't have to look to the West. We don't have to look anywhere else. We have the expertise in our own country to serve our continent. So I think that's what we can do. And that's something that I think we should all aspire to do, is to be leaders on our continent. With regards to the third set of comments, which were very technical, and thanks for the opportunity to elaborate on them, the issue around the vagueness of the qualifications and expertise, I agree, and that was one of the reasons why I believe that would be addressed by introducing relevant qualifications in regulations. And the reason that I believe that introducing new regulations would help is because we can amend regulations a lot easier than we can amend legislation. And we could then, as the committee that we set up, which is the Minister responsible for police, the Minister responsible for justice, the National Prosecuting Authority, we could develop, or they could develop, the capacity to see what is relevant and what's not. It would guide our prosecutors, it would guide our presiding officers, it would help them determine whether or not somebody is competent or not. With regards to the issue of the scientific validated process, the reason that I'd used that terminology, and I agree we probably can define it better, is that science is about scientifically validated processes. So in other words, I could walk out of the building now and a bus runs me over. One of my peers or a colleague could be able to literally pick up my case and replicate exactly where it was because the procedure that I've used is scientific and scientifically validated. So I'm using techniques that are used. With regards to the issue of covering the section to include private sector practitioners, it's not so much to say that that you should only appoint a private sector practitioner that falls under Section 51, but the privilege, and I do believe this is a privilege, but the privilege of being able to produce a sworn affidavit or an affirmed affidavit for a court of law setting out what you've done and your findings should be a privilege reserved for qualified practitioners.
What guarantee in that one that you have the person who is not necessarily a policeman? How do you guarantee that person is patriotic, won't be assisting the criminals or foreign government, whatever? What guarantee is there? No, I agree with you. But let's put it there, but I want some kind of a guarantee that person, with his knowledge, now can be an expert in certain things, but it depends on my political affiliation or my objective. If I want to I'm the only one eye person in the world of blind, and my aim is to destroy that person for personal reasons. I make an affidavit. What I'm trying to do, I'm trying to put it.
I think the Honourable Member has a valid point. And the reason I say that it's a valid point is that we see this internationally around the world, this concept of the hired gun expert, where the defense in a case hires somebody, some high-profile individual to come and defend the matter. And the simple reality is we've seen ample instances internationally where people have sold their ethics for money, where it becomes interpreting the evidence in a particular way to address this. And that is why I'm of the opinion that this privilege should only be allowed by persons, parties, or organizations that have been authorized. So for example, In terms of the Justice of the Peace and Commissioner of Oaths Act, we have a situation where people can be appointed as Commissioners of Oaths on application, or we can appoint ex parte Commissioners of Oaths by virtue of the organization they belong to. So, for example, all chartered accountants who are appointed in terms of SICA or members of SICA are ex officio Commissioner of Oaths by virtue of the designation that they hold. I anticipate that we could try and minimize the risks of this kind of hired gun phenomena by designating certain professional bodies or certain categories of persons or something on those lines. One of the issues that I'm personally in favor of, but I think a lot of my peers in the industry would probably disagree with, is I would almost make it a mandatory requirement that anybody doing this work had to carry a security clearance. Because it's very often that we'll deal with evidence that is classified information, so I believe it's relevant. I know a lot of my peers will disagree with me, but that, again, I come from a government background, so that's where I'm comfortable. But I think it's important that we realize that we need to have the right kind of people, the right kind of ethics. And while the argument could be made, for example, for defense parties to have an agenda, I have unfortunately also seen cases from when I was in government where I've seen state actors also have an agenda. How do we address that? So I'm hopeful that the regulations that I've mentioned and the standard operating procedures that have kind of discussed would all talk towards addressing that, so we could actually professionalize the practice of digital forensics like we have with other professions where people's lives are effectively online and at stake.
And can you add on that and have put that provision and draft it and send it to us? Yeah, and addition.
Honourable members, I would...
Thank you. I know we're winding up, but I just wanted your comments on the government structures that are supporting this, because we are sitting here under the Justice Cluster. And the Minister of Justice has got a very small role to play. Have you looked at this now? I mean, most of the issues relating to state security now is under the Cabinet Minister of State Security, and it's reporting only to the Joint Standing Committee of Intelligence, so the public got very little access to that part of it. Then you've got a whole lot of other ministers. And Chair, we might have to hear from those other departments as to their comments on this as well. The police have got a role to play, telecommunications, justice has got a very little role at the end for regulations to promote the information sharing. So what is your comments on that whole aspect, briefly?
Yeah. Thank you, Robert. I'll try and keep it brief. I know we're wrapping up. If I look internationally where it comes to the issue of cybersecurity, we are one of the few countries at the moment that's positioning our cybersecurity structures under state security. In most other jurisdictions around the world, the cybersecurity structures or the cybercrime structures, if I can put them that way, actually fall under either policing or justice or something along those lines because it's seen as a cybercrime issue. However, all of the jurisdictions have cybersecurity capacity in their state security apparatus or in their military apparatus when it comes to, for example, espionage or where it comes to cyber warfare and things along those lines. I honestly think there's some areas that I like about our current submissions in this regard. There's some areas that I'm not 100% comfortable with because I think they might be too cumbersome. But what I think is very important is that for the first time, these structures are actually going to mandate reporting to Parliament on cybercrime issues. Statistics now have to be kept about cybercrimes, for example. Now I've given lots of presentations dealing with cybercrime around South Africa, and often people ask me, what's the state of cybercrime? And to be honest, I can't tell you. Anybody that comes around and says we know exactly how bad cybercrime is actually doesn't have all the facts because we just don't know, because we don't actually keep statistics on the levels of cybercrime in our country. And that will come from the police, that will come from the National Prosecuting Authority. We don't keep those statistics. So I think the structures will help us a lot in terms of betting it. My opinion is I think we need to do more work around it because I think they're a bit too cumbersome, but that's just my personal opinion.
Thank you very much. I think we often say we want to create a better Africa and a better world, and it becomes a slogan. And that's why when you travel, they say, from what part of America do you come from? I was with Alison, Mrs. Alison Tilly in Kigali. She was educating judges. I wonder if they didn't ask her the same question. They don't believe that we can produce high caliber people, and it's very encouraging to see that we have our own who are also patriotic and who can make a difference, not only in South Africa, but on the continent. I hope that the younger ones will follow in their footsteps. We appreciate that. And this was a very, very fruitful day. And I think we have all learned. And we'll see you tomorrow. And the fact that you are the last one to speak, but the house is still full, also shows a commitment of our people to this process. And thanks for the to the Department of Justice for having identified the high caliber speakers.